Hello, America, and to all of our listeners around the world, you're listening to yet another exciting episode of Let's Weekend. This episode is for December 16th, 2016. I, of course, am your host with the most, Brandon Perkins, and joining me, as always, is Filippo D'Onofrio, Patrick Mifflin, and Chris Sologi.
Yo.
Hello.
Yeah, so some things happened and some stuff, as usual.
Yeah. Few people
sun
died.
Still comes well, up. The
I
world
would hope
still
so, because we wouldn't have a show otherwise.
Right. So, nothing really super duper major happened this week that we want to really discuss. Other than, you know, the possibility that the president-elect may or may not have colluded with the Russian government in order to get the election to swing in his favor. But, we're not going to talk about that because, frankly, as much as I kind of wish it was true, I'm not exactly a person who trusts the CIA. So, we do have another political thing we're going to be talking about. It's going to be our asshole of the week. We'll also be talking a bit about the new DuckTales reboot. Yes, that is a thing. It's coming.
Yes.
We'll also be talking about the future of the X-Men brand for Marvel because they just had a big event go down. And then, at the end, we're all going to be doing yet another installment of Gamer Mag Remembrances. This time, we will be talking about the September 1995 issue number 74 of GamePro. And this one is a historic one, and you'll see why.
Yep.
Oh, it's well, September 1995. That's why.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hmm. Or listen to, anyway.
Yeah.
So, with that said, let's start off with what we've been doing. Phil, what were you up to this week?
So, not a whole lot going on this week. Gotten back into Mr. Robot, watched Season 2, Episode 6, and immediately went, what in the actual fuck is going on? Because it starts off, and then the screen goes all 4:3, and then it turns into an 80s sitcom.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that happened. And the funny part is like Elliot is like aware of the laugh track that's going on in there. And he's like asking, did you hear that? And it's like, yeah, it's weird. And yeah, it goes on for a while. Alf makes an appearance. Yeah, it's very, very good stuff. And come to find out, they actually shot a lot more of that. And the full length one is on YouTube. So you could watch the whole extended skit on there. Yeah, it's really good. Elliot is one very, very messed up individual. We'll just leave it at that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So other than that, I've been getting back into learning web development stuff. So I'm doing my HTML5, JavaScript. I did Ruby, Python. So I'm getting all prepared to embark on a big project thing. So boning up my skills, as they say. Yeah, I wanted to watch the Grand Tour, but I kind of ran out of time today, so that's going to happen probably either later tonight or tomorrow. So, oh well. But that's pretty much it for me, but you bet.
Well, as we all know, Pat's been having to deal with computer shit.
Yeah. Well, Phil was here for a good chunk of this, and otherwise I probably wouldn't have completely recovered from it yet. But I did have a hard drive crash, and it did keep me off of the show last week, and among other things. But yeah, I basically ended up having to replace a hard drive and do a fresh Windows install, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one. before Phil pointed out what I was doing wrong and got that whole thing sorted out. So I'm back on a computer that I can trust to not randomly shut off or blue screen on me.
Yeah, which is always a positive thing, you know?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I just use this computer running with a new healthy hard drive in it, the more I realized there were some certain aspects of the way It was running with the old hard drive that were pretty horrifying in hindsight. Things that, sounds that I thought were coming from system fans were not coming from system fans. So I've been getting back on Steam and, you know, just reacquainting myself with a lot of PC gaming that I've missed out on. Just by not having my computer in a reliable state. And I'll be talking a lot more about that on the Day Zero update. But got home from work tonight. First thing I did was sat down and played some Outrun 2006, and that was a fantastic feeling. So glad to just,
be able to just get back in and play that again and not have your computer blue screen at random intervals.
How about you, Brandon?
Well, Chris, why don't you tell us first?
So, I went and saw Rogue One earlier today. And, yeah, that was really good. Definitely a different style of movie than what the... what all the sort of main Star Wars movies have been, as it very much focuses on a specific sort of few days that are about the acquiring of the Death Star plans and sort of how they set up the beginning of Episode 4. And, they do a really good job with that. Because there's not really too much war in Star Wars.
No,
it's like Episode 6 and Episode 2 are the most you see.
Yeah,
and here you kind of see more gritty, violent war.
Yeah,
and it definitely has a great impact on the story and makes the action just feel a lot better.
Is it more of a character driven story or more of a set piece type
thing? I would say it's a little bit of both. It's mainly about Jyn Erso and her father, who is one of the key scientists in charge of designing the Death Star, who has sort of turned towards the Alliance midway through. But kind of sacrifices his ethics in order to keep working on it. But is the person that sets up that fatal flaw and keeps it from everybody else, except for essentially having one of the pilots defect with a holographic message to Forrest Whitaker's character, and eventually his daughter sees it. And you get to see the Death Star in action. It's not fully powered. It blows up a couple of sort of cities and levels them in all the nearby areas with an effect that looks really cool, though. It looks weird because it sort of hits an area, and it's almost like as much as it's like an atomic blast. It's shooting stuff way high up into the air and even in space, as well as shooting out in all directions around it. It's a really cool effect. They did a really good job, and it's a good start for these sort of spin-offs, especially letting these directors that are known for doing interesting things. This one is the guy that directed most recent Godzilla movie. A really cool story there. And they're off to a good start with this these off years, I guess. As long as they don't get to the saturation that Marvel has been, where it's 3 or 4 movies a year. And it's like, oh, here's another origin story. It's just a different guy, but it's another origin story. Here's the one where everybody comes together to save the world or the universe again.
Yeah.
So yeah. Hopefully they do better with that stuff.
Yeah.
I beat Titanfall 2 earlier this week, and that was a lot of fun. They do some really cool stuff. There's a particular sort of chapter called Cause and Effect, where you're essentially time traveling. And it's not so much in the general sense. They more play it off as you are sort of random. Initially, you're randomly warping back to a previous version of the area that you're moving through. And then eventually you're looking for the commander that is in charge of the mission that you're on, and you find him dead, and he has his device that lets you do that manually. And then it turns into a bit of a puzzle shooter where you're trying to warp back and forth to get through obstacles that are in one timeline but are not in the other. And you come into combat scenarios in a similar sense where you're taking these soldiers out in the one timeline, but you go back to the present and it's just monsters that you are swapping between. So it's like, oh, I got in trouble with this side. I'm going to swap back over and take on these soldiers and back and forth and that sort of thing. But it's a really cool setup. And they actually talked a bit about how they actually did it, and they essentially made two separate levels. You just physically warp back between each one.
Yeah, that's how Dishonored 2 does their portaling thing.
Yeah. And so that was a lot of fun. It sort of ends the way you expect it to. It's a story about this pilot and his Titan buddy.
Yeah.
So that's a really cool campaign. I definitely want to play some more of a Doom and sort of see how that goes. Seems like a good year for first-person shooter campaigns.
Yeah.
With those and Battlefield 1 doing its cool thing. And even Call of Duty Infinite Warfare is supposed to have a pretty cool change of pace with the flight combat stuff.
Yeah.
I've also been playing Stories. I forget what the subtitle is on that.
Path of Destiny. Destiny, yeah. Plural.
And that's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And definitely
it's kind of depressing when you first start because it like, doesn't matter what you do, you like die.
Yeah. Yeah, it's sort of like early parts of Groundhog Day.
Yeah.
Where he realizes no matter what happens, he's gonna die.
Yeah.
Or fail, whatever he's doing, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I'm still working my way through that part. And but it's interesting just taking these different paths and like, oh, there's this whole thing about this weird artifact thing that you're putting together, and that causes the death of everything.
Yep.
Are you trying to hang out with your buddy and he turns on you?
Yep.
Well, it's like, and they even build that into the story where it's like, oh, you gotta try again.
Yeah.
And your buddy screwed you over. You're gonna have to see if this next time's the one that gets you through it.
Yep.
And it's sort of like, hey, let's make Bastion, but it's choose your own adventure version of Bastion.
Yeah.
And it's really cool. It's free for PS Plus this month.
Yep.
So people should definitely be playing that. I've also been playing I Am Setsuna.
Nice.
That game is bad when you take breaks between. It does not like getting you up to speed. It doesn't really offer any good way of saying, this is what you were doing before you stopped. So you should continue that. Just like,
and
wow.
This is an issue that should have been solved back in the 90s when Phantasy Star was using the talk mechanic.
Yeah.
Because you just go drop to your menu, choose to talk, and your party will talk amongst themselves about whatever's going on at that point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a thing I like about the recent Dragon Quest. They'll just say, hey, let's talk to your party members, and they'll tell you what's going on.
Yeah.
Or even Trails in the Sky. It's like, here's your list of your missions. You can look at the main story ones, and it'll tell you what you were doing last.
Yeah.
It's like, yep, I know what I'm doing. Here it's like, well, I'm standing outside this village. Was I going in or was I going out? What was I doing when I was trying to do this?
It's like, yeah. Quest log would be really nice.
Yeah. It has kind of story stuff in the like little information part of the menus, but it doesn't really fill it in as you're doing stuff. It waits until you complete it.
Yeah.
It's like, that's really dumb. It's like, if you're going to do this whole retro thing, modernize the right parts of it.
Yeah.
And especially things like the limited save options. Because it seems like there are large stretches you can go without being able to save.
Hmm.
Unless it takes pity on you in a dungeon or something like that. But yeah, it's still pretty good. But yeah, it's lacking at some of the parts where it should have been able to bring that sort of Chrono Trigger style battle system into more of a modern RPG.
Yeah.
And sort of in the wake of beating Trails in the Sky, I've been trying to find something to stick for playing on the Vita.
Hmm.
And so far, Symphony of the Night has been grabbing me a bit.
Hmm.
As I got over a hump, particularly with the boss that you have to go up a bunch of steps and then past like the spinning sword stuff and take out the bird boss.
Hmm.
I don't know what his name is, but you get double jumps soon after that.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, good. Yeah, I can get to all these different places. It was just annoying.
Yeah.
And so I'm trying to essentially get to the similar area, but from the other direction, the other top right corner of the map, where I'm finding a healing breastplate, but I can't get back to the save point from there to keep it. So I keep going over there, getting killed, and it's not healing you fast enough to help you out. So it's like, I'm in a catch-22 here. I can get to this place for something that's mostly useful, but I can't get back, keep it. Because there's only a boss there, and I imagine I have to beat the boss, but I can't beat the boss if I have like a third of my health.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's... I stopped playing that for a little bit. After that, it was sort of demoralizing. I was also playing some stuff like Final Fantasy VI. Still in the beginning, like 30 minutes to an hour, and just kind of put it down for a little bit. Also kind of because of the save situation, just not being able to save as often as I would like.
Yeah.
To be able to bounce out of that more quickly. And along with that, I was also playing some more, some Neon Chrome. It's on Vita. And that game's pretty good on there. The problem is they don't increase the text size.
Oh, joy.
So it kind of looks like the same size it is on the TV, but it's on a 5-inch screen instead.
Super tiny.
Yeah, so it's like there's this box that this text is in, but it's only filling up half of it because that's what it needs to do on a TV, but it's on a Vita and should fill up the whole box. Just increase the text size a couple points.
Yeah.
That would be nice. Instead, you gotta keep sticking it right up in your face to look at the text, see what you're, what sort of perks you're getting. But yeah, that's still pretty good, and that's been mostly it. Like bouncing around a couple things and sort of focusing on Titanfall 2.
Yeah.
But yeah, so what's up with you, Brandon?
All right. Well, first and foremost, I am head deep in The Last Guardian. And Yeah, it's freaking amazing. And I should. The game itself is just. It continues to amaze me in some ways. For one thing, the fact that Trico is so unbelievably intelligent. And just it. Trico himself, you could spend a long time just watching Trico. Because he just, if you do nothing, he'll just go off and do his thing. And it's really hard to describe in words. Because Trico himself, they put so much focus into developing and programming him that he looks so shockingly lifelike.
Yeah.
That just watching him do things is almost uncanny.
Yeah.
So I'm now sort of in a good deal through the game now, and I'm starting to realize that whoever architects it was that designed this freaking structure you're going to was apparently on something, because none of this building makes any goddamn sense. Like, seriously, I mean, Chris is playing it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sure is something. It's a video game.
It's like
architecture.
Yeah.
Why is there a tower off in the middle of nowhere for no apparent reason?
Yeah.
Why do they have these incredibly high walls that only this large creature can hop to?
Yeah.
And why are all these weird hanging pulleys and machinery and stuff that's not connected to anything?
Why is there this vase of some sort of drug that Trico just freaks out over?
Yeah, I've been getting kind of an idea what that stuff might actually be.
Catnip.
We'll get there. But, so there are. And I'll probably re-talk about all this stuff again on Day Zero update, but and Chris brought this up too last time. This is a team eco game, like, through and through, and the controls are one of the best examples of that. They're responsive but finicky.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of it is making sure you're in the right position so that you can grab something or that you can hang off of something.
Yeah.
Because
if you don't see if you don't see that icon, it's just not going to do anything.
There's no icon, but at some occasionally you'll get a prompt that tells you, you know, press this to hang.
Yeah.
But
do those ever go away?
Nope.
Never stopped showing those?
Nope.
I'm a good chunk through the game, and they never stopped showing
those. I was
those.
Hoping maybe, like, at a certain point, they would say, okay, you've played enough. We're just going to start easing up on this.
Well, what I'm thinking is it's going to end up sort of like what they did with Shadow of the Colossus, where some really fucked up stuff starts happening towards the end, and the prompts sort of become part of the game. But I've sort of come across another sort of part of the game, which is through the game, you will come across a couple of things that gets Trico really agitated. One of them is the Shadow Guards.
I like the animation of those things.
Yeah, those things kind of look freaky. Like
stop motion, kind of.
Yeah, it's like a Ray Harryhausen type thing, like Clash of the Titans, that type of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, so if you played, like, Shadow of the Colossus, they kind of look like the statues in there.
Mm-hmm.
It's like that same exact art style kind of thing, but then they start animating and it looks like, holy crap, this thing just turned into, like, a claymation statue thing.
And they're freaky as all hell, too.
Yeah, they're huggers.
They make no sound whatsoever. But yeah, here's the thing. Trico does not like them. And if he sees one, he will immediately pounce on them. and just really just tear them to shreds. And then after he's done, you basically have to climb on him and pet him to get him to calm down.
Yeah, he just starts freaking out after he's done.
Yeah, and but then I found something later on, which I did not make this connection at first when I first saw it, but you come across these things that are, for lack of a better word, they're called, I call them wards. They're basically these big sort of stained glass eye icons that, for some reason, Trico really is terrified of them.
Like, I think it's if a he Japanese sees, thing.
Yeah, if he sees one, he stops in his tracks.
Yeah, in Japan, that's kind of like a scarecrow sort of iconic imagery.
And basically, to get him to go forward, you basically have to find a way to get rid of it, whether that includes, you know, pushing it off a ledge or, you know, throwing a rock or something at it to break it, or in at least one case, basically having to disconnect the cable from it so it'll plunge to the ground.
Yeah.
The thing is, people have talked a bit about how, you know, Trico, when you first start the game, Trico doesn't respond to you that all that much.
Yeah.
It actually doesn't last as long as people think he does, because you and Trico eventually sort of get a good idea of what to do and eventually pretty quickly learn how to sort of go at the game in Trico's pace.
Yeah.
Yeah, once you start feeding him.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, oh, this guy's not that bad.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's what I've been playing. I have also been playing some of the Toho Project. Any of you guys familiar with Toho Project?
Yeah.
Yeah, I know Patrick is. Okay. So, Patrick, tell them what Toho Project
is. Well, I'm not the big Toho fan in my circle. I just know a lot of people who are.
Yeah. Anybody in the anime or manga video game circle will probably have a Toho fan in there somewhere. Yep. Toho Project is a series of bullet hell shooters.
And other various genres.
Yeah.
Whatever the creator decides to make that day.
Yeah. And also supplemented with just a shit ton of fan works. Because it's got a sizable fan community.
Yeah.
And the fan works far, you know, dwarf the actual official material.
Yeah.
Basically, they're bullet hell shooters created by, produced by Team Shanghai Alice, which is staffed by one individual named Zune. That's not his real name, of course. I think his real name is Gioanda or something like that.
Yeah.
And, basically, it's exactly that. They're bullet hell shooters where instead of, you know, your, you know, spaceships and aliens and fantasy monsters, no, it's all little girls in frilly dresses. Okay. It's Japan.
Because Japan.
And, basically, the entire Toho Project games are basically one-man projects. Zune is responsible for, you know, the character art, the programming, the music, scenario, all that. Just the entire thing is all him. Hmm. And they're
also
really...
should be noted for having one of the best safety check-ins ever during the 2011 Tohoku earthquake.
Mm-hmm.
Just goes on Twitter, my beer's okay.
Yep.
And basically what you need to know about Toho is they are all really solid bullet hell shooters. They're hard as fuck. I'm not joking. They are very, very hard. I mean, it's obviously they're difficult. They're bullet. They're, you know, curtain fire games.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not just shooting at enemies. It's shooting at enemies while trying to make your way through a, you know, through the pattern of the enormous amount of bullets that your enemies are firing at you.
Yeah. and being in the two pixels on the screen that won't make you explode.
Exactly. And you know, they are really, you know, I've come to understand why these games have such a strong fan. Okay, I'm sorry, I can't stop yawning. It's late. We're recording this thing at like 9 o'clock. So, yeah. But you know, I understand why these games have such a fanatical fan base. I mean, they are very solid shooters. They're very challenging. It requires a bit of a commitment because, you know, it takes practice. And, yeah, they're great. Good stuff. I had a, but the ones I'm playing are ones I got from the, dark side of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
but you can get them from regular sources. They're all worth playing. Mm-hmm. I would actually start with the 8th installment of the series first as sort of an introduction.
Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily the easiest, but more comprehensive and sort of teaching you the overall mechanics of the series. Mm-hmm. As there's more involved than just shooting.
Yeah.
So I've been doing that and, anime. So, I think I may have mentioned this briefly last episode. I've been watching this anime called Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere.
Yeah, you mentioned that last week.
Okay. Pat, if you're familiar with this series?
I am not.
Okay. So Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere is a anime based on a series of light novels that in turn are based in an overall cycle of light novels that are based around like 6 different phases in this fictional universe. And Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere takes place at a part of this universe that is kind of esoteric if you're not familiar with the material. The books themselves were originally authored by a guy named Minoru Kawakami, who used to work as a scenarist and video game designer before becoming a full-on writer. And I think he tried to be a manga artist at some point, which he still draws. He has a lot of his own artwork on his website, but basically, he created this entire fictional universe with, 6 different ideas in them. And it's basically this really weird thing where it goes into a lot of these really sort of complicated concepts of like time travel and multiverse theory and quantum mechanics and all types of stuff like that. Nice. And if you want an idea of sort of how the timeline of this series works, basically imagine, you know, our timeline basically going the way it does normally. And then right around modern era, all of a sudden something called the concept war happens, where we were sort of at war with a bunch of different multiverses. And then what happens is the timeline sort of goes into a loop where it goes through all this crazy shit and then loops right back around to right where World War II ends. And then the timeline sort of fuses back together and goes back on a normal course. So imagine like one of those loop-de-loops from Sonic the Hedgehog. You know, you start there, you loop around, and then you keep going. And Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere takes place at a time where, like, far off in the future of this universe, where after having gone out into space, mankind decides it doesn't like living out there, so it comes back. So it finds out that Earth is uninhabitable, so they try to redo it. But the problem is that much of their old history from Earth is lost. So what they do is, okay, you know what? I'm just going to read what it says here on Wikipedia. Okay. In the far future, humans abandoned a devastated Earth and traveled to outer space. However, due to an unknown phenomenon that prevents them from traveling into space, humanity returns to Earth only to find it inhospitable, except for Japan, of course. To accommodate the entire human population, pocket dimensions are created around Japan to house the returned populace. In order to find a way to return to outer space, the humans begin reenacting human history according to the Holy Book Testament. But in the year 1413 of the Testament era, the nations of the pocket dimensions invade and conquer Japan, dividing the territory into feudal fiefdoms and forcing the original inhabitants of Japan to leave. It is now the year 1648 of the Testament era, and the refugees of Japan now live in the city ship Musashi, which is basically this big giant spaceship that hovers over Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Which constantly travels around Japan while being watched by the Testament Union, the authority that runs the reenactment of history. However, rumors of an apocalypse and war begin to spread when the Testament stops revealing what happens after the year 1648. Taking advantage of this situation, our hero, Tori Aoi, head of Musashi Arya Dust Academy Supreme Federation and president of the Student Council, uses this opportunity to lead his classmates and try to regain their homeland. Did you catch all that?
That's messed up.
Yeah.
That sure is something.
Yeah. So basically, this is sort of the issue that the anime has at first, because it kind of has to info dump a good chunk of this stuff in the very first episode.
It's like, bleh, here you go.
Yeah, so that first episode is a giant what the fuck from beginning to end.
Yeah.
But basically all what you really need to understand about the universe that this particular series in takes place in is that because of that, what I call the concept war thing that happened earlier with the going to war with, when they had to go to war with like 10 different other alternate dimensions. After the war ends, they have to take all the concepts from those individual universes and bring it into their own, unless, you know, space and time basically disintegrate. So what this basically means is that by the time of Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere, all mythology, fantasy, and science fiction is true. So, okay. You know, you'll see robots, Shinto deities, dragons, elves, succubi, incubi, some weird Indian dude that's obsessed with curry. Just all of that.
Yeah.
Oh, and did I mention that this is primarily a school story?
Yeah, I kind of got that.
Yeah, so that's Horizon in the Middle of Nowhere.
that's a thing.
Oh, yeah. For the record, you can actually find a lot of Minoru Kawakami's light novels translated into English on novelupdates.com. Just go there, and you can read a lot of this weird-ass shit for yourself.
Yeah.
So, that's what I've been up to.
Yep.
So, has anybody got anything else they want to add?
Yeah, give you a quick quick tip before we move forward. Go to club.ubisoft.com. You got 7 or 8 free games that you can get your hands on right now. It might be over by the time of the Day Zero update, so I'll just mention it now. Bundle includes Assassin's Creed 3, Rayman Origins, Splinter Cell, Beyond Good and Evil, Far Cry 3 Blood Dragon, The Crew, and I think if you go into the Uplay client, you can just get Trials Fusion for free as well. But that may be limited. So, yeah. Free games. Oh, yeah. And Prince of Persia Sands of Time. So
yeah. Which is still worth playing even today.
Yeah. So, freebies. Freebies are good.
Yeah.
Yes. Best price of all.
Yep.
Oh, for the price of Uplay.
Yeah.
Well, valid.
To be perfectly fair, Uplay has improved considerably since the last time I looked at it. So, yeah.
Sure, but it's just this weird scenario with PC gaming now where everybody has a client.
Yep. Yeah. Would be nice if we had just one client to rule them all, but that's what Steam would have ended up being, but oh well.
Yeah, it'd be cool if you could get keys for those games and redeem them in Steam.
Yeah.
All right. Well then, I'm guessing it's time for yet another installment of everybody's favorite part of the show, Brandon's Random Factoid. And this time, well, I'll just go ahead and say it. So, as humans, we have all have certain things that have been sort of consistent with our with the existence of the human race from its very beginning. You know, we all need to have food. You know, we all crave companionship. Mm-hmm. We all like to go out and enjoy the sunshine.
Mm-hmm.
And we also need to spank it. And the thing about this is that there were times in human history, especially in the Western world, where finding things to help you spank it was difficult, to say the least. And I'm not talking about, you know, when you're a teenager in the 80s fiddling with the cable box just so you could see some statted out boobs on the Playboy channel.
Yeah.
Which is totally stuff people in the 80s used to do. No, I'm talking about trying to publish books that are technically supposed to be considered pornography, but are done in such a roundabout and vague metaphoric way that to the untrained eye, it doesn't look like porn at all.
Hmm.
You're probably thinking, okay, how the hell does that even work? Well,
I think
I'm going to tell
you. Going with this.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you.
Hmm.
So, back in the 1700s, you know, the 18th century, if you were living in England and you were a writer and you tried to write the word penis too many times in your manuscript, it could throw you in the clink.
Yeah.
You could basically get convicted for just quote unquote disturbing the king's peace by printing books that were considered pornographic,
yeah.
Such classics of the era as A Treatise of the Use of Flogging and Venereal Affairs, also of the Office of the Loins and Reins. Yes, that is an actual book that was published back then.
Yeah.
So, what do you do? How can you write filthy, filthy porn that doesn't look like porn at all?
Hmm.
Well, let me introduce you to a classic popular text of the era known as A New Description of Maryland. Maryland was basically porn books where they tried to describe what a nude woman looked like by using really, really elaborate geographical metaphors. For example, here's a particular, shall we say, piece from that text. near these forts in the metropolis called Clitoris, it's spelled CLTRS, but everybody knows what the hell it is. It is a pleasant place, much delighted in by the queens of Maryland, and is their chief palace, or rather, pleasure seat. It was at first but small, but the pleasure some of the queens have found in it has occasioned their extending its bounds considerably. That's a very roundabout way of saying, chick's clit gets hard, it grows.
Yeah.
Here's another one. Another part of this country often mentioned by author is Hymen, about which there have been great controversies and disputes among the learned. Some denying there ever was such a place, others positively affirming to have seen it. For my part, after the nicest inquiry I could make, I never could discover anything much satisfactory about it. He's basically talking about whether or not this chick has a hymen still. So, yeah, here's the thing. This wasn't the only type of stuff you could get. Basically, to try to avoid censors back in the 18th century kind of required a certain amount of, shall we say, finesse.
Took creativity, too. So.
Oh, yeah. Hmm. So here's another sample of one that made the cut. This one is called The Voyage to Leith. And it is, once again, it's another one of these types of text. But, you'll see what I mean in just a second as I read this passage. The main mast being alongside, we strove to heave it in, but found much difficulty. Indeed, I thought once I should never have got it righted in her, being somewhat of the largest, but by greasing and working it to and fro, the third day it went tolerably plumb into the socket. I worked night and day upon the rest of her rigging. We took in her cargo stores and ammunition, and were to deliver in the Gulf of Venus. Provided myself next with a very able pilot, whose name was Philip Hancock, a distant relation of mine. and I must do him the justice to say he never once missed a harbor's mouth in the whole course of our voyage.
Okay, I can see how you. I can see how he would be able to get away with that, because, yeah, you could very easily be fooled into thinking that's about naval travel.
Yeah.
No. But, well, they were just too busy laughing too hard to actually arrest him.
But yes, this is basically using nautical language to describe, well, getting it on. Yeah. Now, compare this to another book that was published around that era that was very famous and rather popular and actually got the author jailed.
Hmm.
I'm talking about Fanny Hill, or Memoirs of a Woman of Pleasure by John Cleland.
Hmm.
It barely hit the streets of England before the British authorities arrested the author and forbade the book's further publication.
Hmm.
So, I compared that last one, that last passage. Here's one from Fanny Hill. "By giving us no time to consider dimensions and proving the stiffness of his weapon by his impatience of delay, he threw himself instantly over his charming antagonist, who received him without flinching. We could observe the pleasure lighten in her eyes as he introduced his premonitory instrument into her, till at length, having indulged her in his utmost reach, his irritations grew so violent and gave her the spurs so furiously that, collected within herself and lost to everything but the enjoyment of her favorite feelings, she retorted his thrust with a just concert of springy heaves."
Hmm.
So you see how
it wasn't subtle enough.
No, not subtle enough. And here's the thing. People could still, the authorities could still tell that he was talking about sex.
Yeah.
The metaphors weren't subtle enough. And that's basically how people got off in the 18th century. You know, I mean, for the record, you know, things like erotic prints and stuff had existed since the 1600s. But a lot of those stuff, whenever the authorities got them, would usually burn them.
Yeah.
We still have some fragments of that period, of those prints, but no one has ever been able to find all of them.
Mm.
Because, well, they kept getting burned, torn up, and then reprinted, and then having the, you know, the engravings destroyed, the printers destroyed, blah, blah, blah.
Hmm.
So basically, if you wanted to write something spicy back then, you basically had to write about, you know, hoisting the mizzenmast, as they say.
Yeah.
And that, ladies and gentlemen, is yet another edition of Brandon's Random Factoid. You will never read Robinson Crusoe the same way ever again.
Okay.
And that's not even counting Moby Dick. Man, the things we had to go through to get your fix back in the days, man.
Yep.
All right. Well, moving on from there, we of course have to start off with our asshole of the week. This one, it is just one of the biggest dick moves you could possibly put in. So, who was it that put it in?
I did.
Okay, Chris, describe us what's happening. I know what's going on, but...
Yeah, so one of the most contested states in the country during the election was North Carolina, particularly with their governors, McCrory and what's his name here?
The incoming governor?
Yeah.
Yeah, the last
Cooper.
One was... Yeah.
So when the election came and went, it was too close to call.
Mm-hmm.
So they're basically doing all the recount stuff. And along the way, there was worry that the GOP's...
Roy Cooper, that's his name.
Yeah, Roy Cooper, who the Republicans that were running the Senate were potentially going to be able to just decide who won, whoever they wanted to win. If McCrory went the right route, but he decided not to, and eventually Roy Cooper won. So he's going to be going to office, I'm guessing in a couple weeks.
Before we go further, we should point out Pat McCrory is one of the principal figures behind the whole, what, North Carolina's quote-unquote religious freedom law.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
the one that allows people to discriminate against individuals of the LGBTQ plus community if for quote unquote religious reasons.
HB2.
Yeah, and it cost the state of North Carolina a shit ton of money.
Yeah.
And it's probably sporting events.
And it's probably ultimately the reason that Pat McCrory ended up losing the election.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it should also be pointed out that during this whole recount thing, Pat McCrory was acting like a petulant child. Yeah, you know how all the stuff people, all the things that people, you know, accused Al Gore of doing during the 2000 election, during the recount?
No, he's actually doing them.
Yeah, he's actually doing them.
Yep.
And, but eventually, yeah, McCrory lost. But he and the Republicans aren't going down without a fight.
Nope. So, with Cooper's incoming start to his taking over as the governor, Republican lawmakers decided we're going to start passing some measures to kneecap this guy before he even gets started.
Yep.
Essentially fixing a lot of the shit that McCrory did to anger so many people, not only in the state, but across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Let me see if they have...
See, that is a major dick move.
Yeah.
That is the dickiest of dick moves.
Yeah, I'm trying to see where it's saying what exactly happened here.
Hold on, I'll look at it.
The governor names 5 members to the state elections board, who in turn appoint the 100 county boards, thus the governor is able to stack the boards with partisan supporters. But, let's see, county boards and part of states. Yeah, so they have, like, the whole thing with the gerrymandering. They have to redistrict all of the districts, do new elections next year, and sort of a whole bunch of shit just tied to that.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is actually mentioning, this article is mentioning what specifically they've done.
Basically all you need to know is that they're hampering the amount of power that he as governor will have before he goes back into it. Basically a bunch of the stuff that McCrory could do while he was governor, the extent of his powers, they're cutting that all back just to tell Cooper to go fuck himself.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of people in North Carolina who are not happy about this.
Yep.
There were already protesters. There was some 200 folks who showed up at the state capitol knocking on the door.
Yeah.
Some of them got arrested by the local cops. It's basically a power grab.
Yeah.
There's really no other way to describe it.
Yeah. American politics.
Yep. Now, granted, don't try to act like shit like this doesn't happen in Canada.
No. I'm sure it does.
But, yeah. So, McCrory is a dick even while leaving office.
Yeah.
And all of the people in his party that are still around for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
If you wonder why they may end up becoming a mostly Democratic house for that state, that will be probably one of the many reasons.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, don't mess with their sports, especially their college basketball.
Mm.
And don't fuck with their, I guess, peaceful politics, at least what they want.
Because
most other states, most times, you know, you lose, you bow gracefully.
Yeah.
Here, they're not doing that at all. They're just like,
no, just fuck that.
They're just going to burn everything down before you get in so you don't.
On the way.
Can't do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're torching it and running. But,
yeah.
Wipe the taste out of our mouths because of that. Well,
speaking of dicks.
And speaking of dicks. Oh, this is a fun story. Our heroes of the week. So there's this sex shop in San Bernardino, California, and some armed asshole decided he was going to come in and rob the joint. And the two women employees of that particular shop said, no, fuck you, and threw a bunch of dildos at him until he went away.
Yeah, one of them at least thinks she figured out it was a fake gun. She's like, her quote is, with the gun he walked in, I just thought he was trying to be funny to scare us. Then I saw the gun, and it was like, really? I don't have time for this. So they just start throwing dildos at him until he runs away. There's a good video of this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what you think.
Yeah. It's for some reason, sex shops are always getting robbed.
I don't know why you'd rob that place of anything.
Yeah. Because, I mean, we have, you know, we have our sex shop, X Mart, down here in Macon, and up until fairly recently, it used to get robbed, like, every 4 months, so.
Yeah, unless it's, like, a big chain, I'm not sure they're pulling in that much money.
Yeah.
That's like, you're gonna get a big payday if you knock them off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's most of the, like, physical sex shops these days make most of their money from, you know, restock and stuff like that.
But, yeah, so this place was called Lotions and Lace.
Yep.
So imagine this guy bragging to his friends if it went well, and it's like, yeah, man, I robbed the Lotions and Lace. Got $800 out of it.
Instead, he's going to tell his friends, I tried to rob Lotions and Lace, and they threw dildos at me.
I'm sure they caught him.
Well, yeah.
But... by now.
Well, they have his face on the security camera. So,
yeah.
because the dude was too stupid to remember to cover his face before he walked into the damn store.
Yeah.
Rookie mistake.
That dude is going to have a very, very hard time in the slammer.
Oh, yeah. Well.
That was a good one.
Yeah, he couldn't even get the money first.
Mm-mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, we got some sad news to report. Craig Sager sadly passed away.
Mm-hmm.
Sager was a sports journalist, I believe, right?
Yeah, he's an legendary iconic
basketball
sideline reporter.
Yeah.
Guy who wore many, many different types of suits. All of the pictures and video I've seen of him that various networks and such have made, don't see any repeats.
I think he never wore the same one twice.
And there's definitely players that have made jokes about that. I think Kevin Garnett, after one game, told him to just take that suit home and just set it on fire. By the end, you should just be buck naked. and he'd been battling a really rare form of leukemia. Managed to get it into remission about a year or two ago, but it came back. And essentially was getting about 2 transfusions a week.
Yeah.
Just to keep going. And it seems like his time finally ran out.
Yeah.
And we definitely talked about his amazing speech at the ESPYs, where he basically said, life is just what you make of the time you have left. And it was very much all about not giving up, even if you're given a verdict of your terminal illness and, you know, fighting and just living your life as best you can. And very much is an inspirational person throughout the sports communities. Probably talked to every single athlete in the NBA for the last 20, 30 years. Seems like nobody has any bad words to ever say about him. Even a guy like Greg Popovich, who is known to be very terse to any reporters because he does not like the idea of doing interviews like before halftime or anything like that. Even he was very much in support of Craig Sager throughout his chemotherapy process.
Yeah.
And really, was supportive of him when he came back. Even when it took him 30 years for him to be able to cover an NBA Finals game.
Yeah.
Which he did in this past year when the Cleveland and Golden State were playing. So, yeah, 65 years old. Man, just seemed to do a lot for that. When Hank Aaron broke the career home run record, he was the first person to actually talk to him after that home run. Which is sort of crazy. He was 22.
Yeah.
Just wore like a plain white suit then. And Wayne got crazier suits since then. It's been all over the world. And TV sports reporting will not be the same without him around.
Yeah.
Mm. Yep. Alrighty then. He will be missed.
Yeah. Yep.
So are we skipping these next two?
Yeah, for time constraints.
All right. Well, moving on from that, the new DuckTales show. Yes, that is a thing. It's coming. I personally cannot wait.
Yeah, me either. I want to see it.
This was a pretty big part of my childhood and, you know, Bill's childhood as well.
Yeah. Disney Afternoons. I remember
Disney Afternoon, pretty much the greatest block of car animation that existed back then.
Yeah.
That was on top of DuckTales. We also had Tailspin, Darkwing Duck, Rescue Rangers, Goof Troop, Gummy Bears.
Darkwing Duck, you already mentioned.
Yeah. And then you had some missteps like Mighty Ducks and Quack Pack.
Yeah.
The Goof Troop was still good.
It's all right.
Yeah. But yeah, so, and even by modern standards, DuckTales and those original DuckTales episodes, even by modern standards, are still pretty awe-inspiring.
Yeah.
The amount of artistry that went into each individual episode is pretty amazing considering, you know, that this was like the late 80s, early 90s that these were being made.
Yeah, it was a serialized show, but you really wouldn't know it because the quality didn't really dip.
Yeah, basically, they pretty much all had, every episode pretty much had the quality of a, you know, major Disney film, pretty much.
Hmm.
Producing episodes. It had 3 years and 100 episodes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Four seasons over 3 years, or I guess technically 4 years, but
yeah, that show really sort of makes you realize the sort of lost art of background art, because the scenery in those old episodes, the amount of effort that's put into them.
Yeah.
Like, I still remember that one episode where they were all shrunk down. You know, it was sort of like a Honey, I Shrunk the Kids type of send-off.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were sort of out in the middle of a street trying to survive. And just, I remember because I had that episode on VHS. And I remember just over and over pausing that one particular part of that episode where they're on the street and you get this close-up of, like, all the stuff that's in this trash can, like a glass. There was like a glass bottle and a tin can and just the amazing amount of detail that they went into.
Mm.
That is, you could expect that type of quality in basically all 100 episodes.
Yeah.
But anyway, so the show's coming back and we got a look at the new cast. Mm. Obviously, you know, the original cast is no longer, most of them are no longer with us.
Yeah.
So who have we got? We got David Tennant's going to be there, Danny Pudi, Ben Schwartz, Bobby Moynihan, Beck Bennett, Tox Alec-Yondoy, and Kate Micucci.
Yeah.
Tennant is from Doctor Who and Marvel's Jessica Jones. He'll be voicing Scrooge.
Not a bad choice.
Mm-hmm. His And of course, Huey, Dewey, and Louie will be voiced by Pooty from Community, Schwartz from Parks and Recreation and House of Lies, and Moynihan from Saturday Night Live and We Bare Bears, respectively.
Hmm.
So they've got a pretty good quality cast lined up here.
Yes.
Bennett has been, who's also from SNL, has been tapped to voice Launchpad McQuack.
Hmm.
That's going to be pretty neat to see.
Yeah.
While Ola Gundoy from The Neighbors and Castle will play Mrs. Beakley.
Hmm.
That, of course, was Scrooge's maid.
Yeah.
And finally, Miguchi from Oates of Garfunkel and Oates and Steven Universe, and also an occasional, isn't she also an occasional guest on The Big Bang Theory? Or is that the other one? I can't remember. She rounds out the cast as Miss Beakley's granddaughter, Webby Vanderquack. And hopefully she'll be less insufferable than the original.
Well.
Yeah, that's the one flaw that a lot of those old the Disney afternoon shows had, is they always had the annoying little girl character. Like, you also had what's her name from Tailspin?
Because you can't remember anymore.
Yeah, because you've kind of
blotted her out of your memory.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Man, I cannot wait to see this when it comes out.
Yeah.
I want DuckTales to be a thing again.
Yeah.
I don't want it to just be a meme that everybody, you know, knows. I want it to actually be the cultural phenomenon it deserves to be.
Yeah.
So don't screw this up, Disney.
Yeah.
And sort of to go along with this news, they had the cast sing the DuckTales theme song.
Of course they did.
Of course they did. Pretty much everybody knows it by heart.
But we're not going to sing it.
So I'm guessing they're not going to change that, though.
No. They better not change that, because, that would be...
That shows that song's as big a part of the show as anything else.
Yeah.
It's
super cheesy and awful, but it has to stay.
It's catchy, and it's an earworm.
Yeah.
You know, the only way they can make it better is if they got in some of the music from... you know, the game.
Yeah. And don't dubstep it. Because
no.
No, just no.
Mm. All right. Well, so, yeah. Moving on from that. So, over at Marvel, some shit that went down with the X-Men.
Yeah. They kind of hinted that they really weren't trying to kill the brand. They were just trying to take a step back and decide what to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently they've decided.
Mm. Yep.
And so they're launching a major crossover event called Resurrection. Should be around the start of next year. It will take place immediately following the Inhumans versus X-Men storyline that's going on right now. It just started, really. And they've revealed a whole mess of books that are going to comprise the X-Men brand moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
They're going back to the model that they had in the 90s of having two flagship books.
Yep.
Called X-Men Gold and X-Men Blue, which is a reference to the gold and blue teams from the 90s era.
Mm-hmm.
Back when we had the two main prints as X-Men and Uncanny X-Men.
Yep.
X-Men
was the Jim Lee one.
X-Men Gold seems to be built sort of on the consistency with the all-new, all-different Marvel initiative, if you will. Basically, still focused on sort of the aftermath of recent crossover events and putting a team together led by Shadowcat.
AKA Kitty Pryde.
Yep.
And it and looks, this is gonna be... looking at what I'm seeing, it looks like it's kind of X-Men Gold, in particular, sort of be, yeah, is centering around the characters they introduced in Giant Size X-Men number one.
Yeah, basically, a lot of turnover from Excalibur there as well. But, and it should be noted that the Wolverine in there is not the one that's been in the comics for years and years. That's Old Man Logan.
Yeah. The other Logan is dead.
Yep.
Yeah,
They did a Death of Wolverine story arc a few years ago.
Written by Charles Soule, one of my favorite writers in the industry.
And thus far, they've stuck by it.
Mm-hmm.
It led to a really great series called Wolverines that had some really good legs to it.
Yeah.
Putting together a pretty unlikely group of characters and actually making them work as a team. I think Sabretooth's character development in recent years has been just outstanding.
Yeah.
And they seem to be running with that as well. Not in X-Men Gold. That'll be something for here in a moment. X-Men Blue is going to be something extremely interesting as well.
Yeah, because it's literally the original quintet from the late 60s.
Uh-huh. And here's the thing.
Yeah.
This is not the version of them that's aged like throughout the years. This is a time displaced team.
Mm-hmm.
Brought back from when they were new and put into this Marvel universe that, you know, has had so much happen.
Yeah.
One
small difference though. It ain't Professor X that's teaching them anymore.
It's Magneto.
Yep.
The same Magneto that they had been fighting pretty much their entire existence as a team.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be like,
and that's going to lead to a very interesting dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's another major difference, too.
What's that?
Jean Grey is the appointed leader.
Yeah. That's another big deal, because in the original, it was Cyclops.
Yeah.
That's a big major change from the original dynamic.
Yep.
Marvel sticking to that.
He sort of seemed kind of overwhelmed by watching everything go on that has gone on since, they started this. They called it, All New X-Men, or maybe it was Young X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
One of the two when they brought these characters into the Marvel universe of the present, a lot of shit has happened that you have to understand would gas up Cyclops' head a lot.
Yeah. Because you have to remember, they call him Cyclops is basically the Boy Scout of the team.
Hmm.
Yeah. I mean, obviously in the main continuity, he went through some serious shit and turned into Che Guevara, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
But... yeah, this is the original sort of innocent Boy Scout Cyclops.
Yeah.
Who watched his older self basically commit suicide by Black Bolt.
Yep.
Even though that's not actually how it went down, it's what he knows.
Yeah.
So for those who want to know, the original Blue Team that we know of actually started back in 1991. That was the X-Men number one, the one that Jim Lee was in charge of with Chris Claremont.
Yeah.
So that was Cyclops, Rogue, Gambit, Wolverine, Beast, Psylocke, and Jubilee. So basically all the characters you remember from the Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah.
And Jubilee.
Also from the Saturday morning cartoon at some point.
Yep.
Yeah. And I have a bunch of those old... not issues from the early 90s. And what I get the feeling from with Jubilee is they were trying to redo the whole sort of story arc that Kitty Pryde went through when they first introduced her in the late 70s. And it just doesn't work.
No.
Because Jubilee is just way too early 90s.
Yeah.
They've done some pretty cool stuff with her lately.
Yeah, she's a vampire now.
Okay.
Just going to throw that out there. She's a vampire now.
I mean, that's pretty normal for X-Men.
It's like nothing surprises us at this point.
Unfazed.
Yeah, they just...
No,
it was,
no, they've made it work.
Yeah, they made it work. Right. They basically just had to... They just... It was just a stroke of genius that they had.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. More on her in a moment.
Yeah.
So the third book in the line is Weapon X, which seems to be a follow-up to the Wolverines series that I was talking about before. This seems to be focusing on a team of Wolverine, X-23, Deathstrike, Warpath, Sabretooth, Domino, and Old Man Logan.
So basically X-Force.
Yes.
It's the X-Force, minus Cable. And the horrible Rob Liefeld artwork. I actually own some of those old X-Force issues, by the way.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because you'll look at the letters pages and there are people just praising the hell out of Rob Liefeld's artwork.
Yeah. It's like, okay.
But a thing about Sabretooth that you have to understand for both Wolverines and Weapon X is he basically underwent an involuntary shift of personality back during the Axis story arc, which was also a lot of fun. So now you have Sabretooth, who is a sincere redemption seeker, basically trying to rebuild himself in the image of Wolverine. And it's been very interesting watching him go down this trajectory as a character, because it's completely refreshed him. There really wasn't a whole lot more they could have done with him before.
Once your basic character arc goes down to blood dripping sociopath, there's not really that much more you can go.
So I definitely expect him to be one of the standout characters in this series, too. So the next one, Generation X.
Ooh, want to talk about 90s.
Yeah. This was one of my favorite X-Men books when it was in its heyday. Just bring in a whole mass of new characters and develop them well, at least while the initial team is working on the book. And I really feel like you can still go back and read those first at least 2 years of it and just thoroughly enjoy it. Definitely one of the high points of the X-Men line. And they're rebooting it. Basically, it's a new school with a new team. And Jubilee, who was one of the students in the late 90s version, is now the headmaster.
And all that entails.
It should be pointed out, no longer even a mutant. Just a vampire. Who is... you have to say deeply invested in the concept.
Oh, and if you're thinking her wardrobe has changed any since the early 90s,
nope.
They've made a few adjustments here and there, but the character is still extremely recognizable.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
They're
not just, you know, she isn't wearing the, you know, hot pink Air Force shades anymore. Now they're just regular pink shades.
So, as for the roster itself, this is going to be interesting. Because mostly established characters, unlike the first time around. Kid Omega.
Yep.
And that's going to be the cause of much heartburn at the school, just in and of itself. Bling.
Yep. I remember her. She showed up in 2005 first.
Kind of a side character, and I guess developed into the all new X-Men line. So that was an interesting group of characters too.
Yeah.
I think she was one of the first. She was also, if I believe, one of the first openly gay characters that they had too.
Yep.
Hmm. Well, I mean, openly gay as far as X-Men members are concerned.
Yeah.
I-Boy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's from the Grant Morrison era, isn't he?
I'm not sure. I'm not.
Nope. He's actually from 2012. Never mind.
Hmm. Okay. Let's see.
God damn, Benjamin he looks freaky.
And this is funny because this kid got put through shit as sort of almost initiation, which was also one of the great Emma Frost moments in among many.
Yeah.
Nature so Girl.
Benjamin, he's a shapeshifter, right?
Uh huh.
Yeah.
With particularly limited range.
Let's see who else we
and,
got.
And as a sort of exam, he was basically ordered to break into SHIELD headquarters.
Yep.
Well, that's kind of suck.
So Nature Girl is in there. No surprise.
She's a new one.
Popular. Yeah. And then the one new character is called Hindsight, who has a mutant ability described as psychometry.
Mm-hmm. Basically, so she can communicate with the use of plants and animals.
Hmm.
Oh, and she also has antlers.
Oh, no, that's Nature Girl.
Yeah, you're talking about. Oh, you're talking about
Hindsight.
Yeah, the
one new character that they're introducing for this.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this is. They say they're going to go to some lengths to give this series ties to the original, which I'm extremely happy about. Okay, I actually do like this psychometry ability, the way they describe it.
Yeah.
Understanding the past of a person or an object by touching it.
Mm.
Interesting.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Very fitting for this particular series, too. Like, he is that kind of character.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, out books. Of the entire line, this is the one I'm looking forward to the most, I think.
Mm. Yeah.
That and X-Men Blue.
Mm.
And then there's a whole mess of solo titles. They're going to be continuing the Wolverine X-23 series. Cable's getting another series.
Of course.
Iceman is getting a series.
You get a series, and you get a series.
But the great thing about it is this is it's a whole mess of titles in the X-Men line.
Yeah.
Mm.
There was a time I didn't think we were going to see that again.
Mm.
And I kind of suspect the whole Inhumans plan that they had going either wasn't in the first place or it kind of fell on its ass.
Yeah.
Because it started when the Inhumans movie that they had planned fell off the calendar.
Yeah.
Like, it's probably still a thing. It's probably in development hell as we speak. But it's not happening before a decade that begins with the number two. And the push in the comics to ramp up the Inhumans has not been as well received as they probably would have liked. And so I think it's making them second guess the whole push.
Yeah, I think this is probably the better way to go.
Yes. Like, even if they remain lukewarm on the X-Men as a brand in the mainstream, as far as crossover projects, obviously Marvel vs. Capcom Infinite is included in that, and just trying to downplay the cinematic universe to, you know, whether it's to leverage Fox or whatever, no good is done by weakening the X-Men line as a comic product.
No.
Nope.
And if they're starting to get some semblance of sanity from, you know, on that front, then this could go to some pretty good places, and I'm already liking the creativity and the potential of what's been put forth just at this point.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, then, the time has come. Here it's time for yet another installment to round up this episode of Gamer Mag Remembrances.
Yep. We got a really good one this time.
Oh, we've got a fantastic one. And
an important one.
Yeah.
An important one. It is the September 1995 issue of GamePro, issue 74.
Yep.
And this particular issue is historic for a number of reasons. First things first, this was the month that the PlayStation came out.
Yeah.
The original. And it was,
also coming right... Well, no. Okay.
It was also the year that two of the greatest JRPGs made their way over here to the U.S. Final Fantasy VI, which we knew as Final Fantasy III, and Chrono Trigger.
Yeah.
That and a bunch of other amazing shit came out this around this time, too.
Yeah.
Yoshi's Island.
Yes.
Yeah, that, too.
And Battle Arena Toshinden and a bunch of other stuff. Mm. So, let's jump right in, shall we? Yeah. Everybody on it?
I got it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so...
Yeah, obviously, for all of that historic stuff, it's Primal Rage on the cover.
Yeah.
They can't all be winners.
Yeah.
We'll talk a bit about Primal Rage a little later.
Yeah.
So, first things first. Oh, the first ad is for Batman Forever, the video game.
Yeah, next.
I won that game for free from Blockbuster, and I still wanted my money back.
Yes, so this was probably the most notoriously awful Batman game that was ever made.
Over 125 awesome moves, gadgets, and attacks.
It was more or less a precursor in every meaningful way to Mortal Kombat mythologies.
Yeah, not in a good way.
It even ran on the MK engine.
Yeah.
Yep. Which should have been a sign that Mortal Kombat Mythology Sub-Zero was probably going to fall flat on its ass.
Yeah. Passion projects, what can you do?
Yeah. So we go there, and oh, we got an ad for Chrono Trigger.
Yay, much better.
Wow, that is one hell of a...
That is it's very a 90s-ass ad.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
Half of the first page is just red with black text on it.
Yeah.
But, hey, it was an amazing game. What can we say?
Yeah.
And we're going to talk about it a little bit more later. So after that, oh, there he is up there in the corner. Scary Larry.
Yeah.
He was, for a lot of people, he was the face of GamePro, for lack of a better term.
Yeah.
GamePro's Hot Tips Hotline.
Yeah. Call him up. Charge your parents' phone bill.
Aren't
out
those
the
two
ass.
Guys real enthusiastic?
Yeah.
Like, yeah, we gotta do this.
I just have to interject for a split second here because I just got a notice on my phone that Square Enix is doing a live stream in Japan right now. Mm-hmm. And Phil and I were talking about this the other day. What do you bet it's Noctis for Dissidia?
No, I'm sure
probably.
He'll be showing up for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the game's doing really good, so, I mean, obviously it's not going to do anywhere close to the sales numbers they wanted to, but...
Yeah.
No, I was talking about this just yesterday with Phil, that I was kind of surprised that Noctis wasn't ready day and date of Final Fantasy XV release to drop in the arcades as a time release.
Yeah. Yeah. I missed it by a few days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right.
If that's what this is, I can only imagine. Yeah. Anyway.
We'll have all the dates on Sunday.
Yep. And let's see. And this is, we got an ad for some baseball game. I can't tell what that is.
Frank Thomas, Big Hurt Baseball.
Oh, right.
Yes. That was not a good game. Just putting that out there.
Yeah.
Especially when you don't have the name of the game in the ad.
Yeah.
Mm.
It's kind of on his helmet, but not really. Yeah. It's just Big Hurt.
Yeah, let's see. Then we got the table of contents. We got an ad for
Go Dog.
Yeah.
They've got the cover on the table of contents page.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Okay.
I gotta remind you what magazine you're reading.
Yeah. As if the 80, 90 dozen, you know, subscription cards they shove into the magazine that you have to go through don't remind you already.
True.
Yeah.
If you need to remind you, you're a nerd, there's Clear Sled.
Yep.
I gotta ask, though, as a regular subscriber to many of these magazines back in the day, I was always just awestruck how many of these magazines made it to my house without those little cards falling out of them somewhere along the trip.
Yeah, because, well, they were, like, you know, just jammed in there pretty hard and friction.
Pretty much, yeah.
Kind of kept them in.
Yeah, so let's see. We got more cable contents. We got another ad, this one for Levi's.
Okay.
Or Levi's, as I've also heard it pronounced.
Which is interesting in a way, because it was it's like most of the gaming magazines that we've seen pretty much focused around gaming ads.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This one here, well, maybe it's the time frame or whatever, but it seems to have
that money
mix. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, typically games and anime.
Mm.
Yeah. And here we've got an ad for Ridge Racer.
Okay, I've got my happy now.
Yeah. Remember, yeah, like we said, this is the month that the PlayStation came out.
Yeah.
This was one of the titles they were really pushing when it debuted.
Yeah,
it was about all that, and Toshinden were just about all it had on launch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was worth. Well, no, it had Jumping Flash.
Oh, it made launch.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, they got the PlayStation advertising going on with the "You are not Red E."
Yeah.
Yeah.
Red E.
Enos lives.
Mm.
Yeah, because Enos was a Red E.
Yep.
Red E, 9th of September.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And you look at these graphics now, and they're pretty primitive.
Yeah.
But when we saw this shit back in 1995,
nothing.
Well, it was
like
really
this.
The beginning of the end for arcade supremacy as far as the technological edge.
Yeah. Yep.
Because you had Namco working with arcade hardware that was specifically PlayStation based. That should have been a sign.
Yeah.
And if you could sharpen up these graphics, you could actually release this today for like $15.
Yeah,
it's true.
Like an HD remaster of the, say, all the PS1 Ridge Racers.
Yeah,
yeah.
Namco.
Well, what I'd love to see is if they just did an HD remaster of Ridge Racers 2 on the PSP.
Yeah.
Mm. All right. So moving on from that, we've got the letters section, and. Let's see, what have we got in here? We've got the,
This earlier, and this, to me, was like the height of high-grade editorial trolling.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, everybody see that symbol up at the top of the page?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, does everybody recognize that?
Yep.
Yeah, that was so back when Mortal Kombat 3 was out in the arcades and, you know, basically crowding out every other game in the damn arcade.
Yeah.
Basically, back in Mortal Kombat 3, it had this sort of code system built into it.
Yeah.
And basically, you had these sequence of symbols that you would put in at the versus screen before every match. And if you got the right amount, got the right type of symbols in there, it would have various effects on the game.
Yeah.
And a lot of them required the cooperation of your opponent.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all of them, really.
Yeah.
Because you could only do four. Because it was a sequence, I think, of eight symbols.
Six.
Yeah.
Six, right.
Low punch, block, low kick.
Yeah, and you could only control three of them yourself.
Yeah.
That particular symbol is basically a crudely drawn Goro.
Yeah.
Who was one of the symbols you had to put into the symbol line to, you know, get the effects.
Yeah.
There were so many early MK3 ads that had those in, even before anyone knew what they were talking about. The first MK3 ads had those little six character, almost hieroglyphic, just characters along the bottom.
Yeah.
And nobody knew what it was. And then when the game came out, you had this system in place and people started decoding them. And I think most of the codes actually circulated by way of ads.
Yeah,
pretty much.
Which was
brilliant. That or the internet.
Yeah.
Which was still in its infancy.
Yeah. You couldn't really get away with that today because the entire code list would be busted wide open within an hour.
Yeah. Hour. Actually, I'd say within the first. I'd say within the first 15 minutes myself.
That's true.
Yeah.
They just data mine it.
Yeah.
And let's see. Oh, look over that picture. Recognize that thing on top of the Genesis?
32X.
The 32X.
The Black Mushroom of Death.
Yeah.
I'm looking at this picture of Mario Picross.
Yeah.
Somebody complaining they're not reviewing enough Mario games. Like, hey, we reviewed Mario Picross.
We're reviewing everything they send us. But before we turn the page, I just... and this is the editorial trolling I'm talking about. Read that first letter. It's short.
Mad about it? The one about the ads?
Uh-huh.
Okay, it says here, I'm an avid reader of your magazine with only one complaint. The ads. F your magazine is ads. Nobody pays attention to them, so why have them? An unknown gamer replied. The unknown gamer, by the way, was the guy who was in charge of doing their letter page.
Yeah.
He replies, nobody pays attention to them. See the next six letters.
All of them with random allusions to the ads that have been in the magazine.
Yeah.
Here's one. It says, some of the ads from MK3 have said, one has to pay dearly for immortality. One has to die several times while one is still alive. Nietzsche. What's Nietzsche?
Yeah. See,
back before the days of Wikipedia and Google.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was the MK3 thing. Your July 94 issue had an ad on page 25 showing Virtua Racing for the Genesis under the rating symbol of a steering wheel and the word steering wheel compatible. Is there such an attachment for the Genesis?
Nope.
That would have been incredible.
Says here, just the Sega was going to sell it last year. That would be 94. But
Virtua
those plans
to
were...
the Saturn.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and turn the page then. We got the letter art. The envelope art section. That back when pretty much every magazine did that.
Yeah.
And
some people were very talented.
Yeah,
look at the effort that went into that Street Fighter the movie art.
Yeah. And compare it to the one that won.
Yeah, it's more effort than it deserves.
Yeah.
That's what I was kind of angling towards.
The Royal Julia one looks really good.
Yeah.
The other's not so great.
Yeah.
The high detail, though.
All right, and then we have an ad for Phantom 2040 for...
That was a thing.
Yeah. Oh, Lord.
Wasn't that a Saturday morning cartoon for a while?
Yes, it was. It was one of the numerous versions of the old Phantom comic strip. Which had been around since the 1930s and apparently is still ongoing, I've been told. Turn the page and oh my god.
If you could go back in time and warn these people, would you have the heart to do it?
If it meant that Gunpei Yokoi would be able to stay on Nintendo for a little longer.
Stay alive?
Yeah.
Valid.
Yes, I would warn them.
Yeah.
But part of me wants not to, just because I'm really vindictive against the assholes that were running the company at the time. And part of me thinks they needed a disaster like this.
Yeah.
That controller sure is something.
Yeah. Those of you who are following along but maybe still aren't quite sure what we're talking about, we're talking about the Virtual Boy.
Yep.
This thing was a notorious disaster.
Helped set back VR for, I guess, about 20 years.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this game almost single-handed.
That's what people thought of as VR.
Yeah.
It destroyed their appetite for it, is what happened.
Yeah,
pretty much.
People tried the Virtual Boy, all excited about the entire concept of VR, stepped away from it. You know what? I'm good.
Yeah.
Which is maybe
I need to go lie down for a little while and take care of this massive migraine I've been suffering.
Yeah.
Why can't my eyes acclimate themselves to the existence of other callers?
Yeah. So, do we really need to describe what the Virtual Boy was?
It was a crude attempt at a headset-based console. It was two screens, basically inside of a visor. They displayed red images on each eye, left and right eye.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the trouble. You played it on a stand.
Yeah.
It's almost like it was supposed to be a portable console.
I'm actually really surprised that there was never some kind of third-party accessory come along to make it wearable.
Duct tape.
Well, I remember seeing... Angry Video Game Nerd do an episode of the Virtual Boy, and he basically just duct taped the thing to his head.
Yeah, that works equally well.
Yeah. But, yeah, and the thing was, first of all, graphics-wise, these things looked ugly as hell.
Yeah, it was, red and black, and
yeah.
That was it.
Yeah.
And it was vaguely 3D.
Yeah.
If you could stare into it that long.
Yeah, if you could get it because... to focus the way you
want. Oh, it could do it. Actual 3D.
Yeah.
Not a lot of it, but it was capable.
And the problem was is that trying to look at this thing for more than 5 minutes would induce headaches. I was listening to, I was watching the Super Metroid playthrough that the Game Grumps did, and Dan Avidan, talked about his experience with the Virtual Boy, and he was in that thing for like 5 minutes, and then he had to run to the bathroom and throw up.
My experience with it was never that intense. To be completely honest, the neck pain was always worse for me than the eye pain.
Yeah. The whole thing is just, it is the combination of just about every design flaw you could think. If you thought the Philips CDI was a badly designed, console, well...
It seems like the Game Gear of... I don't know what you would really describe. It seems like they kind of wanted it to be a portable system because you put AA batteries in it.
Yeah.
But you're not going to move around with this thing or else you're going to kill yourself.
Yeah.
Now, if you're wondering how the hell did Nintendo... think this was a good idea? Well, the first thing you have to remember is this was not supposed to be the final design. What you're looking at here was actually the prototype that Gunpei Yokoi and his team was working on.
Yeah.
And the assholes that run the company basically decided, let's put this out, we'll make boatloads of cash. Now, Yokoi basically warned him, said, no, this is... What are you doing? Not ready! And then, of course, they put it out, and Yokoi had to take the fall for it.
Yeah.
Because life is a dick.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and, you know that there are people who can't see the color red?
Yes!
So, yeah, good luck playing this, if you were one of those people.
Yeah.
Yeah, they picked the red LED because it was the cheapest.
Yep.
Mm.
Otherwise, shocking.
Could have been green. And sear into your eyeballs. That would have been...
Cool. Yeah, if they went with like a full color.
The green would have been as jarring.
Yeah.
Like a full color. I mean, we were already used to it from the Game Boy.
Yeah. It should have been full color, but, they never got around to that.
Yeah, saying it would have been too expensive, maybe about $500 for that thing.
Yeah. That would have flown.
Yeah, if you ever want to hear a good account of how this all went down, just hear Jason rant about it.
Yeah.
I guess they were planning to have head tracking in that.
There's a lot of things that they were planning to have on there. But...
It's going
to
be a head-mounted goggle design, but then turn it to a stationary, heavy precision, steel-shielded tabletop form factor.
Steel-shielded? Yeah. But
conform it to the recommendation of the Sheppens Eye Research Institute. When you have to change the design of your device because of a research institute, you've made mistakes along the way.
Yeah.
Now, if you look over on the right page, you'll see five of the games that would eventually come out for this thing. Enjoy them, because that's basically all of that stuff that was actually released for this abomination.
There's like a dozen games, I think.
Yeah.
Which makes it easy to be a collector.
Well, you can collect all of them easily, except one. One of them is rare.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so I turn the page.
I still maintain that Red Alarm was a very good game that was just ruined by the system it was on.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right, so moving on. WWF WrestleMania at the arcades.
Yeah.
Yep, this is by Midway, them using the technology they used for the Mortal Kombat series.
Yep. Turned it into...
This one was really popular in the arcade back in the day. I remember this. People loved this thing. Mm. Partly because it wasn't really much of a wrestling game. It was basically a Mortal Kombat game in wrestling clothing.
Yeah.
It was just really fucking silly.
It was silly. It was over the top. It was just a lot of fun. Four players on the cabinet. It was good times.
Yeah. You had eight characters to play, and then it came to home consoles, and suddenly you only had six.
Hmm. Until the PlayStation came around, then you had all
that. Yeah. Again. Which, by the way, released the month that this issue went live. So, Listen to me using modern language. I meant this thing was printed.
Yeah.
Fuck. See, then we got an ad for the video game tie-in for Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, the movie.
Oi.
Oi, indeed. All right, turn the page. We got some more arcade stuff. Air Combat 22 and Cool Riders. One of them is looks like a combat simulator, and the other one is motorcycle game.
Yeah.
Moving on.
Well, Air Combat was a predecessor to the Ace Combat series.
Yeah. That's right. Yep. So let's see. Moving on from that. Oh, we got a little thing about people who are the artists in the video game industry. So, y'all get a chance to take a look at that. Some of that's actually pretty interesting.
Yeah. It was this is one of the Primal Rage features in this magazine, and it's the artistic side of that game is actually one of the most interesting.
Yeah. Basically, the Primal Rage, their whole point was they wanted to sort of recreate the whole sort of... I mentioned the name Ray Harryhausen earlier.
Yeah.
In the movie Clash of the Titans. That's basically what they were trying to go for with Primal Rage.
Yeah.
They wanted to make a fighting game that could simulate, you know, that type of stop motion animated battle scenes between big monsters.
Yeah. For the most part, they succeeded, except for the whole.
Yeah.
You know,
they pulled that part off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All they have is an online address. Or what we call email address.
I wonder if it still exists.
Remember, folks.
I don't know, what's the domain?
Yeah.
agames.com.
Nope, that doesn't exist.
Probably not.
Nope. All right, and then we turned the page, we got some more, and then we got an ad for Mortal Kombat, the motion picture.
Yeah.
Which I went to see.
Really solid.
Yeah, I went to see it opening day.
Preview Mortal Kombat on the internet at they got a website here, mortalkombat.com/combatbegins.
That website still works. Doesn't work anymore, I don't think.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they still have the domain.
Yeah.
And then we've got an ad for the Killer Instinct.
Super NES version of Killer Instinct.
Yeah. To be fair, I mean, did a pretty good job for trying to cram.
Otherwise known as we got tired of waiting for the N64 to launch, so here you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's another ad with just big red section of the ad with black text on it.
Yeah.
I'm noticing a theme here.
Yeah.
Yeah. You notice a pattern? And speaking of PlayStation, we got our special feature on the PlayStation with memory cards and combat cables and RGB cables and a mouse.
The mouse, I don't know. Did we see that here in the
Command & Conquer?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of
the combat
run.
Cable, I actually got to experience a little bit.
That I had. So.
Just this house that my friends and I all kind of gravitated to around that time. We'd usually hold LAN parties there, but sometimes we do PS1 System Link for Wipeout XL.
Yeah.
And those were good times.
Yeah.
There's another thing from the 90s, a LAN party.
Yeah.
Yep.
Hey, those still exist.
There's apparently a bunch of games that use the mouse.
Mm. Yeah. So, first of all, your first thing you'll notice, the PlayStation, this one, is actually black.
Yeah.
Is it, or is it just weird lighting?
Could be weird lighting.
Could be weird lighting.
Mm.
Yeah. It looks gray. It looks like they're bright.
It looks like they took
down
a picture of it in a poorly lit room, yeah, and then put it on this fairly light, bright gray background out of context.
Yeah.
Mm.
And it almost looked like a dev kit.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, the PlayStation debuted in America the month that this was published. And if you look over here on the right page, you'll see some of the games that that would eventually come out for it, or at least were announced for it. So we had ESPN Extreme Games.
Yeah.
Which was actually pretty fun. Yeah.
Extreme.
Mm-hmm.
Two Extreme, Three Extreme.
Yeah.
Yeah,
they lost the license for ESPN and eventually actually re-released this particular one as One Extreme.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. We've also got a
version.
That's 90s naming right there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We've also got Air Combat, which, as Pat mentioned, was the precursor to the Ace Combat series.
Mm-hmm.
We have Blades of Rage, which was a flight sim based around helicopters.
Don't think that actually ever made it.
Yeah.
In the near future, when maniacal dictators and random violence dominate the world.
Mm.
So about 2001, 2002?
Probably.
Yeah.
We were so young and innocent back then.
Yeah.
See, so go off from there. What else have we got? We got Destruction Derby.
Mm.
Jumping Flash.
Great game. Great game.
Team 47 Goemon.
Don't remember that.
Don't think we got that here.
Probably never saw the outside of Japan.
Yep.
Probably not. Then, of course, we got the Primal Rage. Again, we'll talk about that a little later. Mm.
I don't know if Primal Rage actually made it to the PlayStation. Did it?
It did.
It did?
Yeah. It did.
Okay.
That was one of those games like Zoop that was just ported to every system and its dog.
Mm.
Mm. And then we've got the next two pages, they're talking with some of the folks working on two games that would eventually come out for the PlayStation and be a big deal. One of them was Warhawk.
Yeah.
And the other one was Twisted Metal.
Yeah. Those were very
How the
big
fuck
games.
Is Zoop the first thing I come to?
I don't know.
See, and here's another thing that was a big deal that you would see on hotlines back in the day. This was especially true for the 80s and also for the 90s. The 1-900 Adventure.
Hmm.
Yes, that's right. Back in the day, you had these hotlines that basically had these choose-your-own-adventure bullshit.
Yep.
That they would call you in. They would purposely talk to you as slow as they possibly could.
And they were games of chance.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That was a great Simpsons joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Krusty hotline.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like that there Sony still wasn't like Sony Computer Entertainment America yet. It was Sony Image Soft.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that was their third-party brand back when they were doing stuff for the Super NES and Genesis.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the Image Soft name went away when PlayStation launched.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When they said, oh, this thing's actually doing good.
Mm.
Let's change our name, get rid of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we had more Twisted Metal-related stuff, and then we got, here's another thing from the 90s, Overpower.
Got my cards.
Yep, that was the official trading card game from Marvel.
Hey, that magic.
And eventually a few other comic prints.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, go through that. They got a bunch
over DC and Image Overpower were a thing.
Yeah, they got a bunch of starter decks here.
It's got charts for you.
Yep.
Tell you how much money they're making.
Mm-hmm.
That's what you do in ads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're making lots of money on this. Buy us.
Well, it's the trading card market, so. Yeah.
Well, no, they're saying how much they're not making, that it's not a ripoff, I think.
Yeah.
Oh.
Because I think FLIR was the ones who printed Overpower, and then their competitors are the ones who have the big chunk there.
Yeah. And so we go through that, and then we have an ad for the GamePro Player's Guides for four different titles. Phantasy Star 4, Final Fantasy 3, which of course is Final Fantasy 6, Road Rash 3, and Mortal Kombat 2.
Which one of these is not like the others?
Yeah.
One of these does not need a player's guide.
Yeah.
Step one, hit guy with crowbar. Step two, win.
Step three, repeat.
Step repeat. Three, instant regret.
Yeah. Oh, man. So, yeah.
That costs more than the others, too. It's $14.
God damn.
Being 13.
Yeah.
Well, so, I would think that they had some pity on the Phantasy Star 4 owners because that game carried an MSRP of $99.99.
Yeah.
Mm.
I guess this technically has Road Rash Sega CD as well in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's twice the content.
Oh. Yeah. So, of course, Final Fantasy 3, that was Final Fantasy 6. What else can we say about it? That game came out, and it fucking floored everyone who played it.
Until Chrono Trigger.
If anyone wonders why I'm pissed off about Final Fantasy 15, just play that.
Yeah.
Reinforce the clowns are evil narrative.
Yeah. I mean, and the Final Fantasy series itself has to be given credit for really being the first sort of major JRPG franchise to actually put a bit of an emphasis on storytelling. Even from the very beginning. I mean, obviously, compared to later games, the story for the first Final Fantasy wasn't particularly elaborate. But
yeah, they had to kind of add to it retroactively.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there.
Yeah, yes. And compare it to its competition at the time.
Yeah, it was kind of just trying to be generic D&D campaign sort of thing.
Yeah. And okay, so we turn the page. Battle Arena Toshinden with a review. Yep. That's right. This one actually got a review. And
this was the launch issue, so they had to review some stuff.
Mm-hmm. Battle Arena Toshinden, what can we say about it?
Well, it was one of the games I got for launch. It got a lot of play over at my place.
It was the first PlayStation game I ever played. I think this game actually like predates like Soul Calibur and mm-hmm. Soul Edge, and it's basically like the first major weapons fighter, at least 3D wise.
Yeah, and the approach they took was more or less taking the Samurai Showdown model and applying it to a 3D space.
Yeah,
yeah, it was basically if Samurai Showdown and Virtua Fighter had a baby. Yeah. It's basically what Battle Arena Toshinden was.
And it took Virtua Fighter a while to get anything resembling Toshinden's sense of 3D.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of sad in hindsight.
Yeah. It also had one of the most infuriating final bosses I've ever encountered in a fighting game.
Really?
Gaia. At the time. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind, well, you have to remember at the time I was kind of new to 3D fighters.
I think we all were.
Yeah.
Yeah, as evidenced by them focusing a good part of this review on camera angles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because this was, again, this was the first...
It was novel.
Yeah,
it was novel. This was a new thing.
Mm.
And, of course, this was back when, you know, you had the original eight fighters, including the likes of Sophia, probably one of the most popular for obvious reasons.
Very.
I'm kind of offended that they only gave the sound a 4 out of 5.
Hmm.
This is one of the best fighting game soundtracks ever composed.
Even compared to the sequel?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And we shall not talk about Toshinden 3, but we just...
Yeah, we kind of ignore that exists.
It had an all right soundtrack.
Yeah.
And that's about all you can say for it.
Yeah.
Now, Toshinden 2, on the other hand.
Yeah.
Now, this is a game that I would have liked the chance to have rebooted myself.
Hmm.
The gameplay does not hold up by any stretch, but all the world building and narrative that they did, there's a foundation you can build on there. And I think if someone was to come in and acquire the IP, then they could do some pretty good things with it.
Yeah. And yeah, as it talks about here, it says it talks about the camera angles. It says unique views. Rather than the usual side view, Tashinden uses a camera angle that constantly zooms around the battlefield. Amazingly, you always remain in complete control of your fighter because the perspective never skews your perception of the controls. And that was big freaking deal in the mid-90s.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's something they would do because they could. We're going to have the camera just flying around all the time.
I mean, just get really nervous if you were close to being ringed out.
Yeah.
Which is why I usually tried my best to make sure I was not near the edge.
Yeah.
And all of
the characters' like evasion animations were all way more outlandish than they needed to be.
Yeah.
3D. I'll say this. If somebody went back and made frame data for the original Battle Arena Toshinden, it would make hilarious airplane reading.
And of course, down here in the bottom of the right page, they give you sort of a general idea of what type of angles you'll be seeing. So
there's one missing there.
Yeah.
What would that would be?
When I was talking about nearly getting ringed out, and you'd kind of get that
tournament
angular camera angle. That's when you knew you were probably fucked.
Yeah.
Probably by Sophia. All right, so flip
I look
the page.
At one of these screenshots is the options. Yeah. It's on the left there.
Yeah.
Look, you can remap the controls. I'm sure that was probably fairly new.
Yeah. So, moving on from there, we've got, there it is, Ridge Racer!
I like the font for that Ridge Racer.
Yeah!
That's like
you never see
magazine.
It anywhere in-game. It's just something they kind of crapped out for their own layout reasons.
Yeah, this is something that GamePro used to do a lot. These sort of makeshift logos and fonts that they would just sort of crap out.
Yeah.
I don't think that car is a thing either.
Nope.
Each letter is just facing a different direction.
Yeah, because 90s.
Yeah, 90s. But again, this was Ridge Racer. And,
Ridge Racer wouldn't see designs like that car until
R4.
Yeah. Yeah. But, yeah.
And let's see. It got, and obviously, down in the corner, you can see it got great review. Got a good review. Fantastic review. Looks like the only issue they had was with the control, and even that was a 4.5.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a screaming face.
Somebody didn't know how to handle the drift mechanic.
Yeah.
See.
Some cars don't have the power to accelerate quickly after a crash, while others can take turns with reckless abandon.
No, you see, you're doing it wrong. If you're not driving sideways, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
And then we got another more
pro
combat.
Tip. You don't need to brake to make it safely through some curves.
Yeah.
Or any of them.
I guess just the idea of drifting was still kind of a new thing.
Yeah.
Well, back then, a lot of magazines were still calling it power sliding.
Yeah. See, then let's see. We got an ad for Mortal Kombat 3, specifically the ones that would be coming to consoles.
Yeah.
Game Gear. Yeah. I remember you. Moving on.
They even tried MK3 on there. It's still astounding.
It didn't work.
No. Oh, and we got Bug for the Saturn.
Yeah.
I enjoyed that.
It was a fun little platformer.
Mm-hmm.
They apparently liked it. It was mostly 4s and 4.5s.
A bug with a butt.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They highlight it right there in the bottom right.
Yes, they do.
Sega had run with that series. Saturn was home to some kind of cool little platform games if you took the time to look for them, especially early in the running.
Yeah. Yeah, just curse Sega for never marketing this thing well enough.
Yeah.
Fuck Stolar.
Yeah.
Stolar.
See, then we got Samurai Showdown for the Sega CD.
I have that.
Mm-hmm. And look at what they gave it down there at the bottom.
Not care for it.
Nope. Mostly 3.5s and 3s.
They didn't hate it. They weren't reaching for their pitchforks, but that sounds about right, actually.
Yeah. And, oh, here's another relic from the 90s. Sega Channel.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You get up to 50 games a month and play them 24 hours a day and kick everyone's butt 7 days a week when you hook in this that thing for pennies a day. Because remember, this was back in the era when if you wanted to get online, they basically charged you by the hour.
Yeah. This came through, your cable connection, so yeah, it was kind of cool.
Sega was really pushing that hard about from the get-go.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
You had Sega Channel, you had SegaNet, I mean, and this was before that you had Netlink.
Yeah.
They were just constantly pushing this online gaming model long before anyone even really thought it was viable. Yeah. And probably before it was viable, but they knew where it was going.
Yeah.
Yeah, $25 activation fee, $15 a month.
Yeah.
Yeah, see, this is one of the things about old Sega that infuriates me. Because Sega had this bizarre ability to both be, one, really forward-thinking and really ingenious, and yet at the same time
but
just
you get to
be...
pay.
Yeah. And then just at the same time just being absolute shit at marketing.
Yeah. Well, it didn't help that they basically had to, try to push this to cable companies and... Well, many of them didn't want to touch it. Mm. So it really limited where the Sega Channel was available. So
yeah,
oddly, it did a lot better in the UK than it did over here.
Yeah. It had about 250,000 subscribers at its peak.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So
the only other company that really seemed to know that gaming was headed in that direction was X-Band.
Yeah.
And X-Band. They were actually pretty...
They had a good run.
Yeah, they had a good run because it was mostly peer-to-peer.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Which is...
Yeah, we've done magazines in this segment in the past where X-Band comes up. And, So, before you had stuff like Xbox Live, that was basically... That was pretty much the only way you could sort of... compete with other players.
Yep.
Yeah.
Outside of the arcades. So.
I mean, it brought multiplayer to games that didn't have any.
Mm-hmm. All right, next up, we've got the...
It got Deathmatch working on Super NES Doom.
Yeah, exactly. And the SNES could barely contain Doom. So yeah, up next we've got the review for the Genesis version of Primal Rage.
Mm.
So I guess now would be the time for us to sort of describe what this was. So back when I first sort of joined up with Smashpad and doing the Day Zero update and, Let's Weekend, I talked about how back in the 90s when fighting games ruled the arcades, all of the fighting games basically... I say all, most of them, because there was a wild card that would come in later. Most of them tried to jump on the bandwagon of two games, Street Fighter II and Mortal Kombat.
Hmm.
Street Fighter II, you got stuff like Power Instinct, Samurai Showdown.
Just about anything SNK made.
Yeah, Fighter's Destiny. Fighter's History, just all these sprite-based 2D fighters.
Yeah.
And pretty much all of them came from Japan.
Yeah.
Then you had the Mortal Kombat-based ones. Mm-hmm. Almost all of them came from either the US or Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically are a good example of how just trying to have the aspects of things does not mean it's going to be as good as the thing you're trying to copy.
Yeah. Found that.
Well, most of them were exercises in style over substance anyway, Mortal Kombat included.
Yeah.
Yeah, so. We have to admit that. but so you had games like obviously probably the some of the most infamous were oddly enough not the the sort of photorealistic type stuff, the digitized graphics, but sprite-based games like Time Killers,
yeah,
and Eternal Champions,
yeah.
There was also Bloodstorm, which I actually really love and still promote as very underrated. But then you had the sort of games like Way of the Warrior, which was an early Naughty Dog game.
Yeah. Kabuki Ninja.
They don't try to talk about that one.
Kabuki Ninja.
No, Kasumi Ninja. Sorry about
Kasumi
that.
Kasumi Ninja. Probably the most...
That one was such a swing and a miss.
Yeah. Yeah. But probably like the most infamous turd that came out of it was probably Tattoo Assassins.
Yeah. Well, it didn't really come out of it. It never saw the end of development.
Exactly. It was so bad.
There are ROMs out in the wild now, but as far as an actual release, it never saw the light of day.
Well, they made two cabinets, and they are the only cabinets of that game that exist.
It's probably how they got the ROM out.
Yeah.
I wonder who's got them.
Yeah. And then you had this from another Midway game, Primal Rage.
It was Midway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Atari.
It was Midway.
It was Atari.
Which... Technically, weren't they? Oh, whatever.
Yeah. It came
Point
out.
Is,
it came out under the Williams banner, which was well, Atari. You know,
that's where things get a little bit muddy.
Yeah.
Regardless.
Yeah. Time.
So basically, what this was, and people used to describe it as Mortal Kombat with giant dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Which is more or less an accurate.
Yeah, more or less
description.
Except, well, unless you're playing as the ape.
Well, two apes. There was actually two of them.
Yeah.
The
ice one, the one with incontinence.
Yeah.
Yeah. The one who had apparently solvent urine. Like one of his finishing moves was literally pissing on you and then you dissolving.
Yeah. Because
that was
of the 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and it sold.
Yep.
Oh, it sold because this game was a big freaking hit in the arcade.
Yeah, it was multi-platform to the nines. Came out everywhere.
Oh yeah, I'm pretty sure they made a version for like a toaster oven at some point. and on the surface, it seems like a fantastic idea. Mm. Like we said, take Mortal Kombat, replace the Mortal Kombat characters with Ray Harryhausen dinosaur characters. Mm. Make it all bloody and graphic. Put it in a sort of post-apocalyptic, you know, world and have, you know, one of the game mechanics being eating your worshippers.
Yeah.
Because you're technically playing gods.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And as far as that goes, it worked. But the game had some major issues.
Yeah, like, you couldn't really control it to any effective fashion.
Yeah, because the control system they created was really convoluted and stupid.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, like...
It's probably the first fighting game to come along that had a concept of what juggling would become.
Mm-hmm.
With... no concept whatsoever of what kind of a monster they were creating in so doing.
Yeah. The actual... one of the things I really hated about this game was the hit detection. The hit detection was really spotty.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there was just the control scheme itself. In most fighting games, you're basically doing, you know... directions on the pad or the joystick and then hit button or buttons. This one you actually had to hold a button or buttons down and then do
directions.
The directions, yeah. Which is
bass ackwards.
Yes.
Brought to you by people who clearly never played the original Street Fighter.
Exactly.
You know that they were working on a sequel to this?
Yep. Yeah, they were. And see, the thing was with the sequel is they were dinosaurs, still monsters, but they also could had like humanoid forms as well.
Mm-hmm.
Supposedly there is a ROM and there is actually an arcade cabinet out there.
Yeah, someone found the prototype.
Mm-hmm.
Not fully working, and but getting there.
It was there.
So,
yeah, Primal Rage, one of the artifacts of 90s gaming.
Yep.
To be honest, I would not be averse to NetherRealms getting the, getting this license, because I think they could probably do some pretty awesome stuff with it.
Mm-hmm.
Got Ed Boon away from Midway, and suddenly he's like this virtuoso.
Yeah.
It's not like there isn't already a precedent of shitty fighting games from the 90s coming back, you know, in this decade. And
Killer Instinct.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't
holding up really well.
But...
Yeah, I guess Warner Brothers got all the rights to... I guess it was Atari Games, which became Midway Games West.
Hmm. Yeah.
They went to Warner Brothers after that.
So they technically do have the license.
Hmm.
And then I guess the fact that NetherRealm has yet to lay a finger on this franchise speaks volumes.
You know what? It's like, you know what's time for a reboot? Pit Fighter. That needs to come back.
Yeah. As the original sure did suck.
The original sucked balls, but...
Good God, it sucked balls. But the idea was so awesome that...
It could so be done well if the time was put into it.
Mm-hmm. Just embrace the beat-em-up side of it and, you know...
Yeah.
Find a studio that gives a fuck.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what do we got? All right, so... next page, of course, we got the tip line, GamePro tip line.
Yeah.
Done in weird photocomic form.
Mm-hmm.
Then we here is another blast from the past.
An anomaly, as it were.
Weapon Lord. This one was for the Genesis, the review that they're doing.
Yep.
Oh,
now,
man.
Now, look at the theme of the game. You look at the name. You look at the overall style.
Mm-hmm.
Which side of the fence would you say this came from? That we were just talking about there being two specific schools of thought.
Well, he didn't know any better. This looks like it could have come from Japan, but
yeah,
it did not.
No, oh, this is an American game.
Oh, wait. I thought it was Namco.
Hmm.
Well, let's see. No, it is Namco. Holy shit. Apparently somebody over there in Japan is a big Frank Frazetta fan.
Because, yeah.
That's pretty much the aesthetic. So, yeah. Weapon Lord was basically a sword and sorcery themed fighting game.
Yeah.
And it had an amazingly complex fighting mechanics.
Yeah.
You know who developed the game?
Mm-hmm.
Visual Concepts, makers of the 2K sports games.
Wow.
See, that's why I said it was American.
Huh.
Yeah, some California boys made it for Namco.
Ah, wow.
That actually explains it.
That explains a lot, actually.
See, I'll admit, I've never gotten around to this one.
Yeah, I played it back in the day. It has got some amazingly elaborate combat mechanics, and it is hard as fuck.
Yeah, this is one of those games that was probably a little bit more complex for its own good.
Yeah. And it was bloody as hell, too.
Yeah.
Like, even by the standards back then, going up against Mortal Kombat 3, this thing was fucking nasty.
Decapitations!
not just decapitations, but then you could split the decapitated head open and expose the brain.
Yep.
Remember Phantom 2040 we talked about earlier?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was also them.
Yeah, and yeah, this game, man, I loved it, but man, it kicked my ass more times than I can remember.
Yeah.
And they apparently liked it too, because it got 4 and 4.5s
yeah.
across the board.
Good game, if you're willing to put the time into it.
Mm-hmm. All right. And then, let's see, we got an ad for World Heroes 2 Jet.
Yeah. Nice.
On the Neo Geo.
Game Boy
version, not this version.
Oh.
This is the Game Boy version.
Uh-huh.
Wow. Never mind.
You're not getting any of this art.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this didn't come from ADK.
No.
Still, I still look back at this franchise, and still I'm just in awe of just the sheer wackiness of its character lineup.
Yeah. This needs to come
back. I'm hoping SNK has it on the menu.
Yeah.
Hmm. Oh, and next up, of course, we've got an ad for the Virtual Boy.
Moving on.
Yep.
At least they tried.
At least they tried. Then we got the Killer Instinct for Super NES.
Yay.
Now, look down at the review bar down there in the corner and see the just the way they look at, you know, just the degrees of separation between what they thought of the graphics and sound and what they thought of the controls and the fun factor.
Valid.
Yeah. But let's face it, this game basically looked and sounded like ass on the Super NES.
Yep.
But it still played really
CD
well.
The CD was kind of the apology for that.
Yeah, you put that on while you were, you know, playing the game.
Yeah. And, yeah, so, and pretty much all these all these characters that are on here, yeah, you can play them on, the modern Killer Instinct.
Yep, every
which
one
is so much better. In just about every way possible.
Yep.
See, moving on, we got Primal Rage again, this time for the Super NES. Again, notice the difference down here, whereas it was 4 and 4.5s across the board for the Genesis one. Here, the graphics only get a 3.5.
Yeah. Not sure how the Super NES version was screwed up so badly, but it was.
Yeah. And then, of course, we got an ad for the Fox Kids stuff. That was back in the... Yeah, so you had the Tick, Eek the Cat, Spider-Man, Bobby.
Mm-hmm.
As you don't remember, Bobby was... God damn, I cannot remember his name now.
Howie Mandel.
Hmm.
That was his cartoon.
Hmm.
He voiced Bobby. You would never know it was him unless you saw it.
Yeah.
And we got Weapon Lord again, this time for the Super NES.
Hmm.
Pretty much the same ratings.
Yeah.
They enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Great use of resources, reviewing games multiple times for each platform.
Yep.
Yeah.
Gotta fill those pages up somehow.
Yeah. And then, of course, over here, Pat.
Lunar.
That Kubooka artwork.
Mm-hmm. Lunar Eternal Blue.
Mm. This was the Sega CD version, I think.
Yep.
We were still about 5 years off of the PS1 version.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, they say the best-selling Sega CD RPG of all time. Is that a competitive drama? Is that like, oh, there's two games?
Yeah.
Well, back in the day, there was serious debate between what was the superior game between this and Final Fantasy VI.
Yeah, there really was.
Yeah.
And of course, you were both wrong, because that was Phantasy Star 4.
But generally, we were just loving life back then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then we got two reviews on the same page, both of them for the Super NES. One of them is Syndicate, which, yeah, everybody remembers Syndicate, don't they?
Oh, great PC game.
Yeah. Doesn't fare that well on the SNES, unfortunately.
Yeah. I imagine it'd be kind of hard to control.
Those are kind of apathetic scores.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, of course, they had the SWAT Cats tie-in. For the record, I was a big SWAT Cats fan when I was a kid.
Yeah, the game or the show?
The show. The cartoon. Oh. It was amazing. Obviously, the game, not so much. I just love the meh look on the...
I think the meh look should have started probably around the 3 on the scale. And then as you go down further, it should just get more and more pissed.
Well, the last one, if I remember in GamePro, the sort of lowest score they gave was like the 0.5, and it was basically a dude.
Projectile vomiting?
No, it was a dude just sticking his tongue out, giving the thumbs down. Just like, ugh. Here's another blast from the past. Blockbuster!
That was a thing.
Yes. That's a few weenies tonight.
So
90s. Da, 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 da. 90s humor.
Yeah.
All right. Then we got another pro review. This one is for the 3DO.
First review of for the 3DO.
Obscure, but they liked it.
Yeah. Zadnos, People's Party.
They really fucking liked it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
3DO did have some good games, but they weren't generally the games you'd think they would be.
Mm-hmm.
Also,
yeah.
$700.
Yeah.
Oh, and let's see. Over here we got
versions of Super Street Fighter 2 Turbo in the early days on a system that only had one controller port.
Daisy chain.
And then we have a they got an ad for another 3DO game over here on the
right hand side.
Yeah,
Iron Angel of the Apocalypse.
Mm. Actually, yeah.
This one
that's right.
I don't think was a good game.
Yeah.
They do a good job of hiding the name.
All right, and next page. Oh, these next two pages, we got two big things of that era. First and foremost, over on the left, we have Rayman.
Yeah, and this one was not the PlayStation version.
Nope, this was the Jaguar version. Which actually
came
out.
Yep.
Where it began. This came out first. And as you can clearly see, they loved it.
Yeah. Did they mention the fact that it has no music?
Yeah, the original had no music.
Still scored well in sound.
Yeah.
Well, they didn't have anything to compare it to. It wasn't that the soundtrack was missing from this version of it. It was that there was no other version.
Yeah.
Nope.
There was nothing to compare it to until they started porting it to
the
PlayStation and the Saturn. Yeah. And
sound keeps pace with the graphics. You get authentic sound effects, along with the standard beeps and thumps associated with platform games.
What's authentic for a setting like Rayman?
Not much.
I don't know. However, the upbeat soundtrack could be from any cute Saturday morning cartoon.
So maybe it did have music.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
Well, it certainly wasn't memorable. and by the way, if you want a really good idea of how 90s this game was at the time, how deep in the 90s we were. Look at what they compare it to. They compare Rayman to. Resembling a cross between Zool and Dynamite Heady.
Well, those are both good games to be
compared. That's high praise, actually.
Yeah. Both of those games, of course, got buried.
Yeah.
By the sands of time.
Still going today.
Mm-hmm. And, Rayman, of course, is still going on today.
Yeah.
And on the opposite page, we have a bit of my childhood. Because I had this.
Oh, I rented this.
Mortal Kombat, the animated video.
Yeah.
I got this for Christmas that year.
Yeah. This was...
I like the big ad for this coupon book.
Yeah, so... Do we really need to describe what this was? It was basically...
It was a Mortal Kombat animated tie-in. It was, I don't know, it didn't run for very
long. No, the actual 2D animation is probably like maybe a third of the actual video, because most of it was this really crude at the time state of the art, but by modern standards really crude three-dimensional stuff. You basically got to see Goro kill Kung Lao and Sub-Zero fight Scorpion.
Yeah.
And I believe Shang Tsung fighting some random dude.
Mm.
and stealing his soul.
Yeah.
And
because you always have to have that.
Yep.
Yeah. And then he had the animated parts, which the animated parts, it's very 90s commercial animation.
Yeah.
You guys remember Good Times Entertainment or Golden Films?
Mm-hmm.
People who would put out those sort of mockbuster version of Disney films.
Yeah.
Yeah, the animation is kind of that grade.
Yeah. Wasn't great.
And they repeat the animation about as much as they usually do in a Golden Films movie.
Yep.
Pretty much.
It has some good voice acting.
Mm.
Clancy Brown, Olivia Dubbo, Luke Perry, Ron Perlman.
Mm-hmm.
These are people who went on to work in Defenders of the Realm.
Mm.
Yep. That's right.
Yeah. Clancy Brown, voice of Dr. Neo Cortex, Crash Bandicoot games.
Yeah. And then finally,
Mr. Krabs.
Mm-hmm. And finally, next up, we got two Jaguar reviews, both of which were meh.
Yeah. That'd be
Power Drive Rally and Air Cars.
Yeah, that could kind of describe most of the Jaguar's library.
Oh, God, I know Air Cars from Broken Pixels.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm trying to remember.
It's like a car combat game, except it's like my first 3D
project. Yeah.
Yeah, that's exactly what it looked like. If
it was
you
like
thought
dongs at the bottom picture on there.
Yeah. If you thought that the graphics of Star Fox were too elaborate,
well,
wait until you get a load of Air Cars. If you thought the scenery in Bubsy 3D was too complex,
well, we have a game for you.
Yeah. Then over here on the opposite page, we got Doom for the SNES,
yeah,
being sold by Toys R Us.
I remember that.
A two-page ad for Doom for the Super NES.
Yep.
You had a free Doom t-shirt if you buy it at Toys R Us.
Yeah. And that is, again, a very 90s ad right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, red background with black text on it.
Yeah, and then the following one. One little brown ant against a horde of black ants.
Yeah.
Which, admittedly, in Doom, you did sometimes feel like that.
Yeah.
So, that much is accurate. Okay, next up, review for World Heroes Perfect for the Neo Geo. This is the version we liked.
Well, it was okay.
Yeah, if you weren't stuck with the crappy Game Boy port of Jet that they advertised a few pages ago, here's what you were playing at the time. Yeah.
Yep. Basically, it gets a 4.5 across the board, so they loved it.
Yeah.
And, again, just insane group of people for a lineup.
Yep.
This also basically had you fighting as a last boss. It was, let's be honest, it was basically Dio from JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. Then we got a Rayman ad.
Mm-hmm.
Again. This one is, and this one, it came out for the PlayStation, the Jaguar, and the Sega Saturn.
Yeah.
And CD-ROM.
Yeah, oh yeah, I remember the PC version.
They more or less relaunched the game.
Mm. Alright. And now we got some sports games coming up.
Yay.
Are we ready for some sports?
Sports ball.
For sporty balls and shooty hoops? Alright, so we got Slam and Jam 95 for the 3DO.
Mm. Nobody played that one.
No. They liked it, though, apparently. Yeah. Let's see. We got Roller Hockey 95 for the SNES.
Hmm. I think that ended up...
I do not remember that.
No, that got a name change. Turned into Street Hockey.
Hmm.
Then we Roller got Hockey International League.
Yeah. Then we got RBI 95 for the 32X.
Yep. Yeah. Because RBI was still going back then.
Yeah. Hmm. Remind everybody what RBI was.
Started off as an arcade baseball game, and then ended up moving to the consoles.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And then we got Hardball 95 for Genesis.
Which was actually quite good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and then we got an ad for Tecmo. What basically was Tecmo Bowl 3, but it was Tecmo Super Bowl 3.
Yeah, the Super Bowl.
For... for Final SNES edition. Genesis. Yeah. Because one of the things about sports games back in the day...
Yeah, it came out often.
Yeah. And mostly because the lineups tended to change. Yeah.
Yep.
Looks like they're about to snap back in the day. Quarterback's neck in that cover art. <It's>
like... Yeah. Knowing what we now know about concussions in the NFL...
That guy killed himself 5 years ago.
Oh, man. Now, let's see. Oh, we got... what do we got here? We got head-on soccer for both the SNES and the Genesis. Mm-hmm. The SNES one apparently made out much better than the Genesis one did.
Mm-hmm. Played either of those.
U.S. Gold.
Ooh. U.S. Gold.
Ooh. They've produced some feces.
Yeah, they have.
Yeah. And then up next, I think this is that one of those George Foreman boxing games.
Mm-hmm.
This one was the SNES, Genesis, Game Boy, and Game Gear. I wish they showed what the name was.
It's, I think that one is, I don't know. Yeah.
And then we get into the next page, we get into the role playing section, and we start off with a review for the massive hit at that point in the year, Chrono Trigger. What really else can you say about Chrono Trigger? I honestly don't know if there's another positive word in the English language that you could possibly add to the description of Chrono Trigger. I mean, just look at the score down there. It got a perfect score across the board.
Yeah. That was hard to do.
Yeah, and it totally deserved it.
Yeah.
I mean, Chrono Trigger freaking blew. I mean, even compared to Final Fantasy VI, which was an amazing JRPG in its own right. This one, it just barely loses to Chrono Trigger, and the reason is because Chrono Trigger was that damn good.
Yeah, Chrono Trigger was just, it had a scale that just hadn't been seen to that day.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the type of scale you get in Chrono Trigger, you wouldn't see really until like around Final Fantasy VII. We're talking, and the thing was, here's what really made Chrono Trigger stand out. The fact that the things you did in the game actually affected the trajectory of the story.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, stuff, the big court scene where they went back on what you did.
And yep, that pretty much, you know, that pretty much starts, put points the trajectory to where the game is going to go.
Yeah.
At that point. And
that one scene had so much clever game development in it.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, really, this game, it was basically the super group as far as the JRPG world was concerned. I mean, you had Hironobu Sakaguchi as, you know, the producer, guy behind the Final Fantasy series. You had Yuji Naka. No, Yuji Ori. Yuji Ori. The creator of Dragon Quest, being director. He had Akira Toriyama doing the art direction and the character design. You had Nobuo Uematsu doing the music.
And Yasunori Mitsuda.
And Yasunori Mitsuda. I mean, that's a twofer right there. You had the scenario and the screenplay written by probably the best, probably one of the best writers in the JRP genre, Masato Kado. He would actually go on to be the guy who would direct Chrono Cross.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty awesome game in its own right. He also was the head guy behind Xenogears later on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And also Final Fantasy XI. That's another thing.
Yeah.
You basically had just all of the best people in JRPG business at the time on one game.
Yeah. People ask, why haven't we seen a game as good as Chrono Trigger since? That's why. That was lightning in a bottle, having that much talent in one place.
And it's showing. Again, this game was that damn good.
Yeah.
And it still holds up.
Yeah.
That's the amazing part.
It still does.
It had lots of replay value for that time.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You think the state of the genre today is more of a talent problem than a priority problem?
I think there's some of
Well,
that.
That combined with just sort of the way the industry has shifted.
Hmm.
Fuck, that was a loaded question. We're still in the middle of a magazine. I should.
Yeah.
All right. Moving on.
Yeah. Fuck.
Because we got to move on. We're never going to get finished.
Yeah.
I am so sorry.
Then we've got an ad for NBA Jam Tournament Edition.
Yep.
Or a home consoles. Damn, that game was fun.
Yeah. That game came out on everything.
Yeah.
All of
Let's see.
Games.
Yeah, we got more Chrono Trigger stuff on the next page. And then we have an ad for Earthbound.
Which features a big fart cloud.
Yes, it
the
does.
Infamous scratch.
And you wonder why nobody bought this game.
Yeah, the infamous scratch and sniff. Then we have Secret of the Stars.
Secret of the Stars.
The SNES.
Never played this one. So, I don't know what I'm missing.
Yeah, I never played this one either.
Hmm. I might have to go back to it.
It looks kind of generic, to be honest.
But generic by mid-90s standards would be phenomenal today.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
That art is...
hideous.
Yeah, it's like, what are those faces doing?
Yeah.
Melting?
My soul. Especially that guy in the back.
I swear I've seen that guy on a soap opera before.
Ugh. It's like he's just photobombing this, cover. This scene.
Yeah.
Oh, just passing through.
Yeah. Let's see, and then we got...
Contest.
Moving on. We got some Game Boy stuff. These are the... pretty sure these are old...
Double packs.
Yeah, then weren't these... Yeah, so like you had Asteroids and Missile Command for one and Millipede for the other.
Yeah.
There was a whole line of them. I had Galaga and Galaxian.
Yeah.
In fact, I think I still got that cartridge somewhere.
Yeah. They were...
Game Boy reviews.
Yeah. And then over here, we've got ad for two tie-ins. One of them was the... tie-in for Dragon and the Bruce Lee story. God, that game was horrible. And then you had the tie-in to Demolition Man.
That was not horrible.
Well, the movie was okay.
16-bit game.
The movie
was
actually,
fantastic.
The movie was weirdly ahead of its time in a lot of ways. Yeah. And you wouldn't know it without actually watching it.
Yeah.
Because the way they sold this movie, they made it seem like a generic sort of futuristic action movie, which was a dime a dozen back then.
Yeah.
It was one of the great pieces of social commentary.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Of the time.
Mm-hmm. Let's see. We move on from that. We got a bunch of, we got some stuff for the 3DO ads, Killing Time and Blade Force. Mm-hmm.
Blade Force wasn't bad.
These ads make those games look 1,000 times better than they probably were.
Well,
yeah.
Blade Force was legit.
Yeah.
Really. Yeah.
These ads are way too busy.
Yeah.
It's like, again, 90s.
Yep.
Tons of screenshots.
Yeah. And then we've got the strategy guide for this issue, which was Primal Rage.
Yeah. Next.
Yes.
Ooh, they...
Check out those figures, though.
Yeah, good art, at least.
Yeah. Mm. If
I
anything...
I don't think that's art.
I don't know.
No, these are actual figures.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah. If anything, this game had amazing art direction.
Yeah.
It really did. Oh, God. Let's see. And, they got the Game Gear and Game Boy Move list here in the back, too. And,
Ooh.
Oh, God, look how 90s. It's a Battle Arena Toshinden ad. Sophia says, spend your money to reserve a Sony PlayStation. Sophia says, give the money to your local video game store and do it now. Sophia says, get on your knees and bark like a dog. Now give Sophia a kiss.
Yeah.
Ah, she didn't say Sophia says. Now she has to hurt you.
Yep, that's 90.
Say that was 90s, but they would still do that ad today.
Yeah, they probably would.
Yeah, but it would probably be for like one of those cheesy budget title games that you see for ads for on the internet.
Yeah.
You know.
That's true.
Like, I expect seeing this picture with the words "Come play my lord" right next to it. You know what I'm saying?
No, you're right.
Okay. Oh, and then we got the Neo Geo CD, an ad for that. Mm-hmm. Neo Geo CD, solid CD, solid console, except for one major problem.
You'll have plenty of time to sit there and ponder your life's choices.
Yes, you will.
Yes, the loading times.
Single.
Even by the standard of that era.
Yep.
Were excessive.
Yeah, they put a single speed CD-ROM drive in there for reasons nobody could understand. Probably cost.
They eventually released a double spin variant.
Yeah, the CDZ.
And then we have, up next, we got what they called SWAT Pro, which was basically their,
tips and
their cheat section, back when cheats were still a viable thing.
Yeah, when they weren't, you know.
Today they're called DLC.
Yeah. Today they're called DLC.
Or they're patched, or they're patched out of the game by the developers when they launch. What happened to Doom?
Yeah. I gotta ask, if we think about it, do we really miss cheat codes?
I do.
I mean, there was something neat about them.
I miss them compared to what we have in place of them.
Depends on the game.
Yeah. I was like, I want to do some arbitrary, weird, random controller combination that get some weird thing to happen. You know, I kind of I miss that.
I miss big head mode. You know?
That was a thing for quite a long time.
Yeah. So, let's see. We got... Some of these are actually pretty neat. Like, okay, Neo Geo, Savage Reign. Okay, who here...
That's an obscure one. Savage Reign. Yeah, I remember that one.
Yeah, it's an obscure yet awesome...
Japanese Fubun collection imported on the PS2.
Nice. Yeah. And Savage Reign, obscure but awesome.
Yes.
And basically, these are your super moves for each character.
I wouldn't really call those cheats.
And, they're hidden stuff. Yeah. So, all that stuff back in the day, they just sort of lumped it together under the same umbrella. Yeah. Now, this was actually neat. Who here remembers Cosmic Carnage? This was actually a fighting game for the 3-2X.
Yep.
And it was positioned as a major part of Sega's plan for it.
Yeah. Now, here's what was neat about Cosmic Carnage, the 3-2X version. There was actually a whole other fighting game hidden inside the game called Cyber Brawl. And that's how you got to it.
I didn't know that.
That is pretty freaking amazing.
If that were just released today, they would just be an unlockable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, you have to hold buttons when you start the game up.
Yeah. Over here on the other page, we got Genesis. We got Ristar. That is a game that Sonic Team would do well to revisit. Say, we got Daytona USA for the Saturn.
Yay.
A couple times there.
Yeah. Both of them cheat. One of them's the sound test. The other is the slot machine, make Jeffrey move, mirror tracks, and time attack. Let's see. We also got Tempo for 3-2X. I think that was a Music Maker game.
Yes, kind of.
Oh, KO Flying Squadron for the Sega CD.
Isn't that game, like, worth more than our whole lives now?
Yeah, pretty much. Which is a shame, because it's a freaking amazing shooter. It really is.
Yeah.
And bizarre as all hell.
Because Japan.
Because Japan. I mean, not quite as bizarre as, say, Parodius.
Yeah.
But it's up there.
I get the impression that this is weird in different ways, though.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, Parodius is weird for the sake of being weird. This seems like something that the concept is legitimately fucked up.
Mm-hmm.
And it had a really elaborate story too.
Yeah.
With like full cutscenes and everything too.
Yeah.
Pretty amazing.
And if you were in UK and you got the demo disc, there was actually a code to unlock a full game. Yeah, they didn't just put the first level in there. The whole game was on there.
Mm-hmm.
Whoops.
Let's see. We got, then next page, we got codes for Panzer Dragoon for the Saturn.
Yep.
Again, another franchise that has been unjustly
neglected.
Yep. And then we got a bunch of Game Genie and Pro Action codes.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was back when those things were still viable.
Yeah.
And would get you banned from online services that were kind of critical for the usage of your console.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. And then we got, after that, we got an ad for College Football USA 96.
Joy.
With all of the teams precursor listed.
Sort of precursor to the
NCAA
football.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. See, I'll just see if I can find my Georgia Bulldogs on here. My Georgia Bulldogs.
Utah State.
Let's see, Colorado, Eastern, Florida Gators, Florida State. There they are, Georgia Bulldogs.
Joy.
Here's the thing.
Actually quite a bit of content to be cramming onto a 16-bit cartridge.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. I live in Macon, which is Bulldog Country. This
it's
is a part of. There are few college football rivalries in the country that can equal the insane amount of just pure loathing between Georgia Tech and UGA. People get shot over shit like that.
I believe it.
Iron Bowl.
Yeah.
Ohio State, Michigan's way bigger.
Mm. And next stage, we got the Fighter's Edge, and it's for Street Fighter, the movie, the game.
This was not a high point month for this feature.
Nope.
No. And actually, these are the secret characters, I think.
Yeah.
This game actually had them.
Yeah.
Surprisingly enough, and God, this whole part of the Street Fighter franchise was just lousy.
Yeah,
I mean the movie sucked. You know the game tie-in was just stupid.
Yeah,
the G.I. Joe figures were stupid and made no sense.
Yeah,
it was also the transition from Super Turbo to Alpha One.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That happened around that time. Mm-hmm.
Let's see, and then we got moves for Battle Arena Toshinden.
Okay, here's where I got a bitch about.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
So I got this in the next page.
Mm-hmm.
Look what Street Fighter the movie gets. And now take a look at
Toshinden Fighter
on this page and Virtua Fighter on the next.
A little incongruous.
Priorities?
Not here.
Nope.
Priorities much,
yeah.
Game Bro?
Capcom was paying some money back then.
Mm-hmm. And then after that, those two, we have an ad for the Jaguar.
CD.
Yeah.
Hooray!
Yeah, they wanted to compete with Sega on the console add-on business. Stack more dumb shit on your dumb console.
Yeah.
That whole console add-on thing, you know, the couple years that existed really was just really stupid in hindsight.
I have to ask. I've got a list here of 12 games coming soon for the Jaguar CD. Did these all see the light of day?
No. Read them off. I can tell you.
I don't think maybe one or two of them did.
No, read the list.
Let's see. We got The Realm. Let's see. They are Realm Fighters.
Don't know. Don't take that one.
Robinson's Requiem.
Nope.
Canceled. Wait, later released by Songbird Productions.
Hover Strike.
I think that one did come out.
Yeah, it's exclusive.
Rise of the Robots.
Yeah, that one.
Well, that one got ported to all of the things, so I'm sure that one saw the light of day.
Yeah. Black Ice, White Noise, Wayne Gretzky Hockey, Demolition Man.
I think that version came out.
Highlander.
I think that one actually did come out for some reason.
Yeah, Aldi's. Verona's Forces.
No idea. Boy.
Soul Star.
I know that one came out for the Sega CD. I don't think they...
Yeah, some of these aren't even listed on this wiki for games.
Magic Carpet. Yeah.
Magic Carpet, I think, did.
Yeah, like Myst is on this list. Space Ace.
Blue Lightning.
VidGrid.
Yeah.
Dragon's Lair.
Jaguar CD was not a good system.
Yeah.
And it still didn't fix the one problem that Jaguar had, which was the exposed...
All right. Next up, we got Peripherals... And the buyer's beware thing.
Yeah.
And,
I remember these.
The Virtu Stick, the Hori Fighting Stick SS, and the Arcade Racer.
Yeah.
I wish the Hori had circulated better than it had. I still have two Virtua Sticks to this day sitting around somewhere.
Yeah, they weren't. The Virtua Sticks weren't built too badly, so.
They weren't. The precision level doesn't really hold a candle to the stuff you can get today, but what does?
Yeah.
I mean, they were good to play Super Turbo on or Alpha 2.
Yeah, that's all we had back then, so.
Yeah.
And we're already running over 3 hours.
Yeah, let's try to finish this up here.
Well, the thing is, there's like a bunch of stuff for the next few pages, so... You want to maybe we'll just end it here and we'll come back to the rest of it maybe next episode?
Yeah, okay, I could go with that.
All right. Well then, we'll go ahead and wrap things up here because of time constraints. But I want to remind you folks, those of you listening out there, you can email us at letsweekenders@gmail.com. You can also listen to us on iTunes, Google, and let's see, I need to look at the list here.
Tune in and RSS.
Yes. You can listen to us at iTunes, TuneIn, Google Play, or RSS. Yes. So, with that, I have been your host with the most, Brandon Perkins. Join us next time for another episode. And for Filippo D'Onofrio, Patrick Mifflin, and Chris Logie, I would just like to say good night. Get some sleep out there.